They call the Caribbean a paradise. Blue water, white sand, rum cocktails. But that's just the picture on the postcard. What if the real story of these islands lived not on the shoreline, but in the hills where maroon drums still echo? In kitchens where colonization shaped the taste of pepper and breadfruit? In carnival streets where African resistance wears sequins and feathers? This journey is not a vacation. It's a cultural excavation. I set out to explore 10 Caribbean islands, not as a tourist, but as a documentarian, walking where sugarcane once bled, listening where language evolved, eating where survival became creativity. Each chapter peels back the glitter to reveal the deeper truth, that paradise was built on history, migration, rebellion, and reinvention. This is the Caribbean told by its storytellers, chefs, dancers, fishermen, grandmothers, and griots. One island at a time. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Jamaica. Roots, rhythm, and resistance. I arrived in Jamaica just after sunrise, when the clouds still sat low over the hills and the sea whispered at the edge of the runway like it had secrets. Montego Bay's airport is a blur of sun-faded signs and warm welcomes, but I wasn't here for the beaches. I came to listen. In Jamaica, everything has rhythm, not just the music, but the way people move, the way stories unfold, even the way pain is passed down. It's not always obvious. Sometimes you need to leave the resorts behind and head into the countryside, where the air is thick with history and the land still remembers everything. I wasn't chasing postcard Jamaica. I was chasing the kind that sits under a breadfruit tree, stirring Callaloo, remembering who came here and why. The Land of Motion, Montego Bay to St. Anne. The road to St. Anne Parish winds inland from the coast through landscapes marked by banana trees, rusted zinc roofs, and graffiti that reads like gospel. One love, black liberation, no justice, no peace. In the town of Brownstown, a woman sold me a patty from a tin tray while telling me about her grandfather, who farmed these hills before independence. "He say de land, talk to him," she said. "I think he mean memory. Jamaica don't forget." She handed me a bottle of ting and pointed down the road. "If you go 9 mile, tell Bob I say respect." 9 mile, birthplace of Bob Marley and something bigger. 9 mile is a village, yes. But it's also a shrine, not just to Bob Marley, but to what he stood for. Black consciousness, cultural identity, and resistance against Babylon. The word Jamaicans used to describe colonial systems, corrupt governments, and spiritual oppression. I followed a guide named Jermaine through Marley's childhood home, a two-room shack where the walls are thin, but the presence is dense. Burnt incense, scratched vinyl, faded portraits of Haile Selassie. "This is where Bob used to meditate," Jermaine said, motioning to a stone slab behind the house. "People think music is entertainment. Nah. Fiwi, music is survival. Bob Marley isn't just an icon here. He's a mirror. The questions he asked about identity, exile, justice, they still hang in the humid air. And then there's the tomb. It sits in a cool, a rounded mausoleum decorated in red, gold, and green. People remove their shoes before entering. It feels more Ethiopian Orthodox than Rastafarian. Inside, silence. You can hear yourself breathe. You can hear your history answer back. Colonial bones, Jamaica's uneasy past." Driving further inland, I passed remnants of sugar plantations, broken aqueducts, falling stone walls, and wide-open fields that once held thousands in chains. Jamaica was once the world's largest sugar producer. For over 300 years, Africans were kidnapped, branded, and brought here to die, all in the name of profit. That past isn't just in the textbooks. It's in the soil. It's in the surnames. It's in the national motto, out of many, one people. A beautiful phrase, yes, but also one born of violence, intermarriage, rebellion, and erasure. At the Seville Heritage Park, I walked among Taino artifacts and Spanish cannonballs, stood near the outlines of slave quarters, and touched a tree that had survived it all. A woman who worked in the gift shop told me her grandmother used to make soap from ashes and lime, a maroon recipe, she said. We're not just survivors, she told me. We storytellers. A Night in Negril, Where Freedom Sings. That night I arrived in Negril, a beach town that dances to a softer beat. No cruise ships, no mega resorts, just open air, live reggae, and a constant hum of waves. I stayed in a family-run guesthouse at the edge of the cliffs. No air conditioning, just ocean breeze and the sound of cicadas. A local named Ras Marcus played guitar by a fire pit and told me how Negril was a haven for Rastas in the 1970s. Government didn't want we down in Kingston, so we come west, he said. Here, we smoke, we reason, we love. We talked about Ital food, repatriation, and whether the global image of Jamaica helped or hurt the people here. He said tourists come for the rum and the beaches, but leave without hearing the real song. Jamaica not hotel. Jamaica is vibration. Culinary resistance, the politics of the plate. The next morning, I ate ackee and salt fish, green banana, and breadfruit roasted over open flame, cooked by a woman named Miss Gloria, who ran a roadside stand between Negril and Savannah Lamar. This is food of survival, she said. Enslaved Africans make this from what white man throw away. Salt fish? Was ration? Ackee? We plant that ourselves. Every bite held a story of forced migration, adaptation, and invention, of turning scraps into ceremony. Even the drinks told tales. Sorrel, a West African hibiscus drink. Morbi, bitter fermented bark. And Roots Tonic, a slow-boiled brew of herbs and aphrodisiacs tied to maroon herbalism. In Jamaica, to eat local is to eat history. Where to stay? Cultural immersion in Jamaica. Local guest house, Negril. The West Ender Inn, on the cliffs, family-run, sunset views, approximately $90 per night. Heritage stay, Montego Bay. Mint retreat, small, personalized, access to local tours, approximately $140 per night. Eco retreat, Blue Mountains. Mount Edge guest house, foggy mountain views, hammock mornings, approximately $85 per night. Things to do in Jamaica, cultural explorers list. Visit 9 Mile with a local Rasta guide. Walk the ruins of a sugar estate at Seville Heritage Park. Eat ital stew with maroon descendants in the hills. Attend a local Nyabingi drumming session. Ask quietly. They're not tourist shows. Visit Bob Marley's mausoleum barefoot. Talk to an elder over ackee and salt fish. Budget snapshot. Jamaica, 3 days. Food and drink, $65. Lodging, $180. Heritage sites, $25. Transportation, $90. Local experiences, $40. Total approximately $400. Final reflection. Jamaica isn't just a place, it's an archive. An archive of stolen people who rewrote their fate in music, language, and flame. A living museum of resilience disguised as a vacation destination. From reggae to rice and peas, from rebellion to reverence, Jamaica doesn't ask you to relax. It asks you to remember. And once you've heard it, really heard it, you'll never see the Caribbean the same way again. I left Montego Bay not with a tan, but with a notebook full of names, sounds, flavors, and a single phrase Ras Marcus had said, still echoing in my head. We are not what they say we are. We are who we say we are. Chapter 2, Jamaica, From Cloud Forests to Concrete Truths. The Blue Mountains greeted me not with sun, but with fog. Soft and blue like a veil draped over memory. Up here, 4,000 feet above sea level, the air no longer smelled like salt, but like cedar, wet leaves, and roasted coffee drifting from hand-built farms. I had left the beaches behind, chasing the altitude and attitude of a different Jamaica, the one that resists silently, breathes deeply, and holds its history close in the clouds. Blue Mountain Coffee, a crop with colonial teeth. I reached a coffee estate near Mavis Bank, where narrow trails wound between rows of Arabica plants. These beans, delicate, slow-growing, shade-loving, had once been the pride of British planters. Today, they are Jamaica's global luxury, often priced at $60 per pound. But behind that price tag is a story of sweat. Errol, a third-generation grower, took me through the process. He showed me how beans are hand-picked before dawn, dried on racks that must be covered in rain, and then roasted in small batches in barrel-shaped drums. "Dem call it premium," he said, "but people don't see die-back pain, don't see we mother's hands." Coffee, like sugar before it, was never just a crop here. It was colonial capital. And now it's a symbol of revival, resilience, and reclaimed pride. Holywell, the sanctuary above. From Mavis Bank, I hiked toward Holywell Nature Reserve, a protected space in the Blue and John Crow Mountains. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, not just for biodiversity, but for history. These were the strongholds of the Windward Maroons, Africans who escaped slavery and carved freedom into the forest with machetes and music. The trail cut through giant tree ferns, moss-covered bamboo, and whispering pine. In the distance, the faint beat of a Nyabingi drum echoed through the fog. Not a performance, but a prayer. I met a young ranger named Alicia, who took me to a lookout platform. "Over there," she said, pointing through the mist. "That's where Nanny of the Maroons used to watch dem soldiers." Nanny, warrior, priestess, mother of resistance, is now Jamaica's only national heroine. Her image is on the $500 note. Her spirit lives in every twist of that mountain trail. The view was vast, blue, and quiet. No Wi-Fi. No billboards, just legacy. Kingston, Pulse and Paradox. The descent into Kingston is both literal and emotional. You go from serene forest silence to a city that never stops vibrating. Horns, sirens, sound systems, motorcycles, street vendors selling jelly coconuts and jerk chicken, all tangled in concrete heat. But beneath the chaos is clarity. Kingston is where Jamaican culture takes form. Through dub plates and dance halls, street murals and political graffiti, bold patois and quiet grief. It's the cultural workshop of the island, even if the tourists never make it this far. Bob Marley Museum, a temple of sound and struggle. I visited the Bob Marley Museum on Hope Road, the former home of Jamaica's prophet of peace and defiance. Inside, the air was heavy, not from incense, but from the weight of memory. The bullet holes from the 1976 assassination attempt still scar the walls. The mixing board where Marley recorded Exodus still hums with electricity. His bedroom is preserved, untouched. Our guide, Marlon, spoke like a poet. This house was base camp for revolution. Fee, Bob, music was a weapon, not a product. We stood in the meditation room, where Marley used to kneel beside a burning candle, reading from the Psalms and playing his acoustic guitar. On the wall, a photo of Haile Selassie beside a print of Marcus Garvey. Outside, in the courtyard, the red, green, and gold fluttered like flames. Trenchtown, the soul of the city. To understand Kingston, you must go to Trenchtown, the birthplace of ska, rocksteady, and reggae. But it's also a place of fire. Decades of poverty, gang conflict, and state neglect have scorched the community. And yet, music still grows here, like cassava in dry soil. I met a local youth leader named Andre, who showed me the old government yards where Marley, Peter Tosh, and Bunny Whaler once lived. He pointed at a bullet-riddled fence and said, "Every artist come from a crack. Even concrete can sing." In a small community studio, kids were laying vocals over trap-infused reggae beats, lyrics about school struggles, police raids, lost cousins, and burning hope. This wasn't a tourist attraction. It was a cultural greenhouse. A dinner of layers, salt, fire, and memory. That evening, I dined at a small restaurant called the Grog Shop, tucked inside Devon House, a 19th-century mansion once owned by Jamaica's first black millionaire, George Steeble. The contrast was striking. White linen, candlelight, silverware on polished mahogany, all on a property built by empire and rebellion. I ate pepper shrimp, oxtail stew, and bami soaked in coconut milk. It was high cuisine layered with history, enslaved ingredients, freed technique. Every bite was a whisper from a different century. Where to stay? Kingston and Blue Mountains. Cultural heritage, Devon House area, Spanish Court Hotel, stylish, safe, culturally central, approximately $180 per night. Eco Lodge, Blue Mountains. Mount Edge Guest House, forest side views, local meals, approximately $85 per night. Community Guest House, Trench Town, Culture Yard stay, immersive, humble, authentic, approximately $60 per night. Things to do. Jamaica. Part 2. Cultural Deep Dive. Hike the Blue Mountains through maroon land. Visit Bob Marley's home and meditation room. Explore Trenchtown Culture Yard with a local guide. Taste history at Devon House. Sip authentic Blue Mountain coffee on site. Attend a dub session at Dub Club Kingston. Budget Snapshot, Jamaica, 3 days, part 2. Lodging $170, meals and drinks $65, entry fees $30, transportation $90, local guides $45, total approximately $400. Final reflection. Jamaica is a country of contradictions, mountain stillness and city vibration, colonial ghosts and freedom chants, bullet holes and bass lines. But if you listen carefully, the rhythm aligns. Here, a resistance isn't always loud. Sometimes it looks like a coffee farmer with earth under his nails. Sometimes it sounds like a child rapping in patois on a cracked mic. Sometimes it smells like oxtail stew, carried on a Kingston breeze. This isn't the Jamaica from travel brochures. This is the one that still fights for its soul, and sings while doing it. Chapter 3. Barbados. Beneath the sugar and the surf. When you land in Barbados, everything feels pristine. Roads freshly paved, hedges trimmed, pastel-painted homes kissed by sea salt and sunlight. It's not performative. It's the rhythm of the place. There's a sense here that things should be in order, even when the past wasn't. But for all its postcard gloss, Barbados isn't just about beach days and rum tastings. It is a crucible of British colonialism, black intellectual resistance, and a rising tide of national pride that runs far deeper than tourism ever sees. This was the island that once served as the prototype for plantation slavery, long before Jamaica or South Carolina. And it's also the one that gave us Rihanna, road tennis, and the world's youngest republic. Barbados is a paradox, beautiful and brutal, graceful and defiant, and that tension is its power. Bridgetown, bones beneath the boulevards. I started in Bridgetown, the capital. It felt strangely familiar. Georgian architecture, narrow British-style roads, Anglican churches standing stiff among modern storefronts. But look closer, and you'll see the echoes of empire whispering from every limestone wall. I walked through the Garrison Historic Area, once the largest British military base in the Caribbean. The cannons still stand, pointed toward an ocean that once brought ships full of sugar, and people in chains. A local historian named Althea guided me through the George Washington House, a preserved colonial residence where the future American president once stayed in 1751. "People love that trivia," she told me. "But what they don't ask is, how many enslaved people built this house? How many died here?" She led me to a field nearby, now a cricket pitch. "That was a burial ground," she said quietly. "They covered the bones with grass." Cheapside Market, stories in every stall. Midday, I found myself in Cheapside Market, where the scent of nutmeg, thyme, and frying fish floated through humid air. Women sold herbs in reused plastic bags, their patois blending into an island-wide symphony of commerce. I bought a Bay Jun salt bread sandwich, stuffed with flying fish and hot pepper sauce, from a vendor named Merton. "Tourists don't like it too spicy," he laughed. "But real Bay Jun tongue need fire." He told me how his great-grandmother was born on a sugar estate and lived to see Barbados raise its first independence flag in 1966. "She say we didn't get free. We got clever." His laughter trailed off, but his eyes held weight. I asked if he thought the new republic status changed things. "We still owe we ancestors answers," he said. "Republic or not?" Plantation Shadows, St. Nicholas Abbey. The next morning, I drove north to St. Nicholas Abbey, a 350-year-old Jacobean plantation house turned heritage site. The drive was lush, mahogany trees lining narrow roads, monkeys darting through cane fields, wind rustling through tamarind leaves. The house itself was beautiful, in that unsettling way colonial estates often are. Perfect symmetry. Mahogany woodwork, porcelain teacups, sugar mills preserved like museum pieces. But it's what wasn't displayed that stayed with me. The names of the enslaved who once outnumbered their masters by the hundreds. In a small exhibit room, a backlit screen scrolled through documents, baptism records, sale slips, punishment logs. Outside, the original boiling house still stands. The scent of burnt molasses lingers like a phantom. A guide named Samuel ran his hand along a brick wall. "Every stone here laid by a back bent too long. Barbados sweet because somebody else paid. Cuisine as cultural inheritance. Back in Speightstown, I stopped at a local rum shop called Fisherman's Pub, more open-air canteen than restaurant, with views of fishing boats and reggae pulsing low under the conversation. I ordered cuckoo and flying fish, the national dish. Cornmeal stirred to a silk-like consistency, fish lightly fried with okra and onions in a tomato-based gravy. A woman named Bernice at the next table leaned over. "You eating de memory?" she said. "That cuckoo is slave food. It's the same ting dem feed in iron pots long before freedom." She told me how her grandmother taught her to clean fish without a knife, and how Sunday lunch was sacred in Barbados, a weekly ritual of endurance and elegance. "Eating is how we stay alive in spirit," she said, "not just body." Where to stay? Barbados, culturally reflective. Mid-range boutique, Bridgetown. Sweetfield Manor, colonial architecture, locally curated, garden style, approximately $175 per night. Coastal Bajan-owned stay, Speightstown. Little Good Harbour, quiet, cultural, family-run, approximately $200 per night. Community Lodge, St. Lucy. Naniki Caribbean Culture Inn. Simple, scenic, historical focus, approximately $110 per night. Things to do. Barbados, Part 1, Deep Culture Edition. Explore Garrison Savannah and its hidden history. Visit St. Nicholas Abbey, ask about the enslaved registers. Taste flying fish at a true rum shop, not a tourist restaurant. Walk Bridgetown's UNESCO district with a local guide. Visit Nidhe Israel Synagogue, one of the oldest in the Americas, a surprising window into Sephardic and Afro-Caribbean history. Spend time at Cheapside Market listening, not just shopping. Budget snapshot, Barbados, 3 days cultural lens. Lodging $200. Meals and snacks $70. Heritage sites $35. Transport, shared plus car, $80. Cultural experiences $45. Total approximately $430. Final reflection. Barbados is more than its beaches. It is a nation built on sugar and silence, now peeling back its own layers with deliberate grace. The past here is not hidden. It's just waiting for the right question. And when you ask it, Barbados doesn't flinch. It responds with rum, fire, and rhythm. This is not a country running from its history. It's one writing its own footnotes in bold ink. Chapter 4, Barbados, Songs of the Republic. When I returned to Bridgetown 3 days later, the entire city felt different. Not physically. The Parliament building still stood tall in their coral stone grandeur, and the wharf still buzzed with vendors and catamarans. But something had shifted in the air. It wasn't tourist season. It was Republic season. On November 30th, 2021, Barbados officially removed Queen Elizabeth II as head of state and became the world's newest republic. The ripple effects didn't explode overnight. They unfolded quietly, steadily, like a tide coming in under moonlight. That tide was what I came to feel. Because this wasn't just about governance. It was about identity, memory, and the right to narrate your own story. From the flag, to the food, to the last name stitched on school uniforms. Freedom Square echoes in the pavement. I stood at National Heroes Square, once called Trafalgar Square, before the statue of Admiral Horatio Nelson was removed. For 200 years, Nelson, a celebrated symbol of British naval might and open slavery supporter, loomed over the city's heart. Today, the square is renamed, repurposed, and reflective. Young artists paint murals on nearby walls, and school children sit on the steps to eat fish cakes and sip cold Morbi. I met a teacher named Devon, who had brought his class to discuss the Republic. "We're not rewriting history," he told me. "We're restoring truth. Nelson doesn't deserve Barbados. Busser does." He pointed toward Busser's statue, a defiant bronze man breaking chains, honoring the leader of the largest slave revolt on the island in 1816. "We put him on the pedestal now," Devon said, "because the ones who fought for freedom deserve the tallest shadows." The rhythms of identity. Crop over and cultural revival. Barbados' most famous festival, Crop Over, began as a post-harvest celebration among enslaved Africans and evolved into the island's biggest annual cultural showcase. But it's more than glitter and masquerade. It's a memory with feathers. I walked through a rehearsal space where tuk bands, traditional Bahan ensembles, practiced their tin pipe melodies. One drummer, a woman named Tamara, told me the music came from pain. "This beat? It used to march people to sugar fields. Now we march to joy, but we don't forget." She explained how each costume, dance, and chant in the Grand Kadument Parade is coded resistance, a celebration of survival. I asked if the Republic changed the spirit of Cropover. "It freed it," she said. "We not dancing for empire anymore. We dancing for we." Bajan Voices, Language and Liberation. English is the official language in Barbados, but Bajan Creole is what fills the markets, buses, kitchens, and schoolyards. I spent an afternoon with Dr. Amanda Hall, a linguist at the University of the West Indies, who is part of an initiative to preserve and document Bajan dialect as cultural heritage. "Creole isn't broken English," she said. "It's a full language born of necessity, rebellion, and rhythm. It's how we hid meaning in plain sight during slavery." She gave me examples. "Wah, ginon." "What's happening?" "He ain't got a cent to he name. He's broke. Take your time. Be careful or go gently." She told me the Republic movement has led to renewed pride in speaking Bajan unapologetically. "In the colonial era, you'd get punished for using this tongue in school," she said. "Now it's on stage, on air, and in Parliament." A visit to Rihanna Drive, global fame, local roots. They renamed Westbury New Road in Bridgetown to Rihanna Drive in honor of the island's most internationally beloved citizen. The house where she grew up is small, bright green, and sits on a quiet block. There's no red carpet. Just neighbors watering plants, boys playing football, and a modest plaque describing her journey from here to the world stage. I spoke to a man sitting on a nearby stoop. His name was Jerome, and he said he used to see her walking to school. "From here to Paris Fashion Week, imagine dat. But she never forget, she from here." He smiled and added, "She's Prime Minister of the people, if you ask me." Culinary Parliament, Food as Sovereignty. That evening, I ate at Oystens Fish Fry, a seaside tradition that happens every Friday in the southern town of Oystens. Dozens of food stalls lined the beach, smoke rising like incense over sizzling grills. I had grilled marlin, breadfruit chips, and cassava pone, washed down with Banks beer and storytelling. I met an elder named Miss Winifred, who told me that before independence, most Bajan meals used to mimic British plates, white bread, canned meat, boiled vegetables. "We used to shame we own food," she said. "Now look, the world lining up to taste it." Food here isn't just cuisine. its sovereignty you can taste. Where to stay? Barbados, reflecting the new identity. Urban cultural stay, Bridgetown, Island Inn Hotel, colonial era charm, cultural programming, approximately $160 per night. Modern arts and design. Stay, Sweetfield Manor, arts forward, reflective of contemporary Beijing expression, approximately $180 per night. Seaside local style, Oystins, Seabreeze Beach House, local leaning, food focused, approximately $190 per night. Things to do. Barbados, Part 2, Republic and Revival. Stand in Freedom Square where Nelson once towered. See Bussa's monument and reflect on his 1816 rebellion. Visit Rihanna Drive and talk to locals. Attend a Tuck band rehearsal during cropover season. Eat and reason at Oystin's Fish Fry. Sit in on a B.A.Y. Jun Creole language workshop at UAWI. Budget snapshot, Barbados, 3 days, modern cultural lens. Lodging $190, food and drinks $75, experiences $30, local transport $70, cultural events $35, total approximately $400. Final reflection. To become a republic isn't just political, it's personal. Barbados is actively rewriting its place in the world, not by erasing its past, but by claiming it with clarity, pride, and precision. This island is no longer framed by empire. It's painting its own portrait, in Beijing Creole, in Rihanna's roots, in flying fish and broken chains. Here, freedom isn't theoretical. It's the bass line in a tuck band. It's the pepper in your lunch. It's the woman who says, without flinching, "We own we now." Chapter 5, St. Lucia, between two pitons and two worlds. I arrived in St. Lucia just before sunrise. The airport terminal in Vieux Fort was quiet, almost reverent, with the scent of salt air and the faint chatter of birds stirring the sleeping trees. A short drive later, the jungle opened up, and there they were, the pitons. Two volcanic spires that rise out of the sea like ancient stone gods, guarding the soul of an island shaped by fire, rain, sugarcane, and war. Between them, stories of conquest and liberation, devotion and survival. St. Lucia is more than a destination. It's a dialogue between opposites, French and British, Catholic and African, spiritual, colonial and Creole, ocean and mountain. This was the only island in the Caribbean that changed colonial hands 14 times. The result? A culture so layered it almost defies naming. But step into a village square or church hall, and the identity sings clear. Soufrière, Cradle of Contrast. My first stop was Soufrière, a town older than Independence, tucked beneath the towering shadows of Gros Piton and Petit Piton. Its name, French for sulphur, hints at the island's living geology and its colonial scars. The streets here are cobbled and close, lined with bright wooden homes whose colors fade gently in the Caribbean sun. Children played soccer barefoot in the alleyways. Smoke curled up from breadfruit grills. Roosters called like timekeepers. I checked into a small eco-lodge on the hillside, and from my balcony I watched fishing boats slicing through silver water, nets arcing into the surf like scripture. I met an elder named Dennis near the Soufrière market. He was selling coconuts and told me his grandfather spoke only Creole, not English or French. "We were born between empires," he said, "but we speak with our own tongue now." the sulfur springs, the island's breathing core. Saint Lucia is one of the few places on Earth where you can drive into a volcano, literally. At the sulfur springs, the ground hisses and belches steam like a living thing. Pools of black mud bubble slowly under the weight of the Earth's breath. The scent of sulfur, heavy, rotten sweet, clings to your clothes, your pores, your imagination. A young guide named Misha explained how the springs have been used for centuries to treat ailments, purify skin, and attract both tourists and spiritual pilgrims. "This is not just geology," she said. "This is therapy. This is prayer." I stood barefoot in the hot mud, let the island smear itself onto my skin, and felt something ancient stir, a heat that doesn't burn but awakens. Morn Kubaril, Shadows of Sugar. A short drive from Soufriere took me to Morn Kubaril Estate, a former sugar plantation turned heritage site. It's a hauntingly beautiful place, cane fields stretching into the green horizon, rusted iron boilers, and drying houses converted into educational spaces. The tour guide, Pascal, demonstrated how cane was pressed in a creaking wooden mill once powered by mules. He handed me a tin cup filled with fresh cane juice, sweet, grassy, and strangely solemn. "Every drop used to be somebody's whip," he said, eyes fixed on the old stone aqueduct. Inside the preserved manor house, the mahogany furniture gleamed, and porcelain plates sat untouched behind glass. Outside, a plaque named the enslaved families who lived and died on the estate. That plaque was the most sacred thing on the property. Quayol and the music of resistance. In the evening, I joined a Quayol storytelling circle near the harbor. A group of elders, most over 70, told folk tales in a dialect that danced between French structure and African melody. There were tricksters like Compère Lapin, cautionary tales about Soukouillon, vampire spirits wrapped in mystery, and moral stories passed from tongue to tongue for generations. One woman, called Tante Irène, sang a belé song, her voice raspy but rhythmically alive. "Men bagay mwendi u, pajan blie sa no te ye." But hear what I tell you, never forget what we once were. Quayol isn't just language here. It's a survival technology, a vessel that carried culture past the borders of empire. Cuisine in Soufriere, fire, fish, and fusion. Dinner came in the form of bouillon, a hearty stew made from green bananas, dumplings, salt meat, and local herbs. It was served in a modest riverside kitchen with one flickering lantern and a strong breeze. I also tasted akra, saltfish fritters, green fig salad, and fresh grilled snapper with lime and seasoning peppers. Not overly spicy, but pungent and soulful. Every meal was a memory retold in flavor. The chef, a former fisherman named Micah, told me, "This food, it's not French, it's not African, it's Lucian." Where to stay? Saint Lucia, Soufriere Région. Eco-heritage stay, budget. Fond du Plantation and Resort, historic, sustainable, rooted in cultural preservation, approximately $145 per night. Boutique luxury, mid-range, Ladera Resort, stunning views between the Pitons, locally sourced everything, approximately $220 per night. Guesthouse experience, immersive. Villa de Piton, home style, Creole cooking, mountain immersion, approximately $110 per night. Things to do. Saint Lucia, Part 1, Soufriere and History. visit the Sulphur Springs drive-in volcano, take a heritage tour at Mourne Cooberill Estate, attend a Quayol storytelling or Belle music evening, bathe in a natural mud bath, hike to Gros Piton or view it from sea, explore Soufrière Market with a local guide. Budget snapshot, St. Lucia, 3 days, cultural focus. Lodging $180, meals and local fare $60, entry and tours $40, transportation $90, community events $30, total approximately $400. Final reflection. St. Lucia is a paradox, shaped by fire, cooled by rain, and balanced between European memory and African inheritance. Beneath the elegance of resorts and the drama of the pitons lies a deeply textured soul, written in Quayol, stirred in bouillon, and sung in the voice of a 78-year-old woman who still believes in moonlight spirits. This is not just an island. It is a language of resilience carved in stone and sung in steam. Chapter 6. St. Lucia. Carnival, cocoa, and the spirit of the hills. If the south of St. Lucia speaks in whispers and memory, then the north sings loudly, colorfully, sometimes off-key, but always with soul. Where Soufrière whispers of sulfur and sugar, Castries shouts carnival and commerce. Where the pitons stand ancient and unmoving, the hills around Grosilet dance, with music, color, and the pulse of a nation remaking itself. I came here during carnival season, but I stayed for something deeper. The revelation that St. Lucia's strength doesn't lie in choosing between past and present. It lies in blending them into something entirely its own. This chapter isn't about landscapes. It's about aliveness. Castries, the capital in flux. Castries isn't beautiful in the way travel magazines want it to be. It's not a place for drone shots or influencer angles. It's gritty, alive, sometimes loud, and always human. On my first morning, I walked through Castries Market, one of the oldest public markets in the Caribbean. The air was thick with turmeric and fried bakes, with shouts in Quayol bouncing off the tin roofs. A woman named Miss Gemma sold me a carved calabash bowl and insisted I eat a pigtail bouillon she had bubbling behind the stall. No man can go war on an empty belly, she laughed. Outside, I watched minivans packed with school children weave past French colonial balconies and new high-rises. An old man sat under a mango tree playing a bamboo flute, a street orchestra with one player. This is St. Lucia's capital, not glossy, but grounding. The hills of Babano, cocoa, community, and ceremony. I drove northeast toward Babano, a highland region known for its cooler climate and cocoa farms. The road narrowed into jungle, and the smell of damp earth replaced diesel. At a small cooperative called El Fleur Cocoa Growers, I learned how chocolate begins, not in wrappers, but in rituals. Claudine, a fourth-generation grower, handed me a fresh pod. Cocoa is a living thing, she said. You don't just harvest it. You wait, you feel, you ask. I watched as she fermented beans in wooden boxes, dried them in the sun, and roasted them in a cast-iron pot passed down from her great-grandmother. We used to hide songs in the stirring, she said. That's how we kept our stories when books weren't allowed. She offered me a taste, thick, bitter, beautiful. This wasn't dessert. It was inheritance. Carnival is decolonial joy. St. Lucian Carnival is a bold, unapologetic contradiction, imported and indigenous, choreographed and chaotic, ancient and Instagrammable. But make no mistake, this is not a European costume ball. This is a reckoning in sequins. I met costume designer Julian at a warehouse outside Gros Islet. Feathers, glue guns, and glitter covered every surface. He was creating for Tribe of Ancestral Fire, a mass band inspired by African resistance. "I'm not dressing people to look cute," he told me. "I'm dressing them to remember." Each costume carried symbolism, from shackles turned into bangles to kente cloth wings rising above crowns. Julian walked me through their meanings like a historian with scissors. "Carnival ain't just play," he said. "It's a language. It says, you tried to erase us. Now watch us shine." Gros Islet. Friday night. Spirit in the streets. I arrived in Gros Islet on a Friday evening, just in time for the town's legendary street party. It was like entering a drum. Every alley pulsed with soca, reggae, and afro beats. Grills popped with smoke. Children danced barefoot beside their grandparents. Locals and visitors moved as one body under Caribbean stars. A Rasta elder named Zion sold rum punch from a hand-painted cart and handed me a cup with a warning, "This will make you dance or confess." Maybe both. I stayed until 2 a.m. That night, I saw a 70-year-old woman. Wine-like time had stopped. I saw two lovers argue, make up, and slow dance under a street lamp. I saw a priest sip Guinness in the corner, laughing with three teenagers. This wasn't a tourist attraction. This was ritual. Faith, folk, and the forest. On Sunday, I joined a La Woz, the Rose Society for morning prayer in the Castries Hills. La Woz and its rival society, La Marguerite, are two traditional spiritual and cultural groups rooted in African and Catholic syncretism. They host elaborate ceremonies, parades, and poetic performances. I expected formality. Instead, I found drumming, praise chants, and dance that felt closer to an ancestral invocation than a church service. A woman named Sister Amelie, wearing red robes and a floral crown, told me, "We pray with our whole body. That's how the spirits hear us louder." She invited me to return in August for the full La Woz celebration. You'll see how a flower becomes an army. Cuisine in the North, innovation meets roots. In Castries, I ate at a family-owned cafe called Blue Coral, where the chef, Patrice, served breadfruit tacos, cocoa-spiced ribs, and a dessert made from sweet potato and guava compote. She told me, "I don't fusion the food, I uncover it." Up the coast, a small beach shack in Marisol served grilled lionfish, an invasive species now turned into a delicacy. Eating it is an act of ecological justice. Every dish told a story, not of origin, but of return. Where to stay? St. Lucia, North Island. Urban cultural stay, Castries. Auberge Seraphin, eco-urban, bird sanctuary view. Approximately $130 per night. Mid-range carnival access, Gros Islet. Bay Gardens Hotel, lively, community-centered, approximately $140 per night. Rural Cocoa Hilltop, Babineau. Green Fig Retreat, off-grid, cocoa immersion, approximately $100 per night. Things to do. St. Lucia, Part 2. North and Modern Culture. Visit Castries Market for handmade craft and quail stories. Attend Gros Islet Friday night for a full immersion in living rhythm. Learn cocoa making at El Fleur Cooperative. Join a La Woz or La Marguerite gathering. Visit a carnival mass camp and understand the symbolism behind the costumes. Eat lionfish by the sea and support ecological resilience. Budget snapshot, St. Lucia, 3 days, carnival season. Lodging $150, street food and meals $60, cultural events $50, local travel $70, artisan shopping $40, total approximately $370. Final reflection. The northern half of St. Lucia is a carnival in the truest sense, not just spectacle, but sacred defiance. Here, sequins and songs carry memory. Cocoa beans become prayer. Market vendors become poets. And the most sacred thing you can do is dance while remembering. St. Lucia doesn't separate the spiritual from the sensual. It blends them into something sweet, fiery, and unforgettable. This is not the Caribbean of cruise ships. This is the Caribbean of soul work. Chapter 7. Curaçao. Echoes in blue and limestone. The heat in Willemstad doesn't press against you. It radiates from the ground up, as if the very coral stone remembers every sun that's ever touched it. Curaçao greeted me in color. Not just the candy box pastels of Handel Scarred, but deeper tones, the cobalt of old sea roots, the golden ochre of synagogue walls, the brown and olive palettes of Arawak cave paintings hidden inland, and always a shade of resistance blue, worn by the island's people like a pulse beneath the surface. This is no sleepy paradise. Curaçao is a living palimpsest, layered, rewritten, fought over, and fiercely held. Its identity is not seamless, it's stitched together, patchwork style, by African rhythms, Dutch codes, Jewish resilience, and indigenous echoes. The island tells its story not in monuments, but in movement, of tongues, spices, histories, and feet on the limestone. Arrival in Willemstad, a city split, a people joined. The capital, Willemstad, is sliced by the natural harbour St. Anna Bay into two historic quarters, Punda and Otrabanda, Dutch for the point and the other side. Bridges connect them, but so does the wind, which carries the scent of seawater, fried arepa di pampuna, pumpkin pancakes, and the smoke of cloves from incense shops. I crossed the Queen Emma Bridge, a floating pontoon walkway, just as a container ship moved silently through the bay. The bridge pulled aside like a courteous host. Locals call it the Swinging Old Lady. And I understood why. Even Curaçao's architecture moves when asked. In Punda, I met a woman named Charlene, selling hand-embroidered linens. "We speak four languages here," she said. "But our silence is also a language. You listen to what's not said, too." She spoke Papiamento, a Creole blend of Portuguese, Dutch, Spanish, and African tongues. It's not just a dialect. It's a monument to survival. Museum Cura Hulanda, Shadows Beneath the Stones. I visited Cura Hulanda Museum, built on the grounds of a former merchant's estate that once dealt in human cargo. The museum doesn't sanitize its subject. It confronts it. Iron shackles sit beside fertility statues. Atlantic maps stretch across ceilings. A life-size replica of a slave ship belly forces you to crouch and crawl just to enter. No room for illusion. What struck me most were the West African relics, carved and painted, some thousands of years old. They weren't presented as curiosities, but as pre-trauma artifacts, reminders that Caribbean history began before slavery. a curator told me. We show who we were before we were stolen. Otherwise, people think we began in chains. Outside the museum gates, a child danced to street drums. Life persisted, loud and unafraid. The caves of Hato, echoes older than empire. North of the city, beneath the flat coral terrain, lie the Hato Caves, a hidden sanctuary carved by water and time. Inside, limestone formations hang like melting chandeliers. Bats whisper from the ceilings. Pools reflect shapes that don't quite exist in daylight. But what gripped me were the petroglyphs, etched by Arawak ancestors who walked this land long before colonizers mapped it. Some figures dance, others hunt. One, a spiral with wings. No one knows exactly what it means. Maybe that's the point. My guide, a university student named Keanu, whispered, "When the Dutch came, they thought these were devil marks, but they're prayers." Chetiboka, where the island roars. Far from the cruise ports, the Chetiboka National Park offers a different voice, one that shouts through crashing surf and jagged cliffs. Boka means mouth in Papiamentu. And here the sea opens its many mouths to devour rock, send up geysers, and paint erosion into art. I watched waves hammer into the volcanic coast, exploding through sea tunnels like cannon blasts. A fisherman stood nearby, indifferent. "The ocean was always louder than the colonizer," he muttered, stringing up his line. At Boca Tabla, I climbed down into a sea cave, where light filtered through a slit in the ceiling. The roar was deafening, like the island was arguing with time. Faiths in parallel, synagogues, shrines, and Sankofa. Curaçao's diversity is spiritual as much as cultural. In a single afternoon, I visited Mikve Israel Emmanuel Synagogue, the oldest still active synagogue in the Americas, where the floor is covered in sand, a symbol of secret worship during the Inquisition. A Catholic church built with African coral and Spanish tiles. A Yoruba altar hidden in a family backyard, where I was quietly invited to witness a prayer in candlelight. Faith here is not linear. It's layered, like the walls of a reef, each belief growing atop the skeletons of older ones. A local historian, Amelia, explained, "We don't convert, we collect. We hold truths side by side." Cuisine as crossroads. In a tiny restaurant called Plaza Bieu, I tasted the island's history one spoon at a time. Kadushi soup, made from cactus. Guyambo, an okra and seafood stew with Congolese roots. Keshiyena, a dish of spiced meat baked inside a hollowed wheel of Dutch cheese, born of slavery, when scraps were survival. I asked the chef what Curaçao cuisine meant. She said, "It means we never waste anything, not food, not memory." Where to stay? Curaçao, cultural focus. Budget. Stay, bed and bike Willemstad, urban, bicycle-friendly, close to local joints, approximately $65 per night. Boutique mid-range, scuba lodge and suites, oceanfront, restored colonial buildings, approximately $145 per night. Cultural immersion, Cas di Arte, local artist-run B&B, Papiamentu-speaking hosts, approximately $110 per night. Things to do. Curaçao. Part 1. Historic and natural exploration. Cross the Queen Emma Bridge by foot. Visit Cura Hulanda Museum for a full historical reckoning. Explore the Hato Caves and study indigenous petroglyphs. witness the power of nature at Chet Boka. Attend Shabbat or tour Mikveh Israel Emmanuel Synagogue. Taste traditional stews and street food at Plaza Bio. Budget snapshot. Curaçao, 3 days, culture plus nature. Lodging $180. Cultural visits $50. Food and local eats $75. Transport and tips $60. Total approximately $365. Final reflection. Curaçao is not a resort. It's a rhythm, not an escape, but an invitation to look closer. Its power lies not in perfection, but in persistence. Across languages, across faiths, across centuries of extraction and trade, this island has carried its soul carefully, like a candle in the wind. Here, blue is more than a color. It is a code, a cry, a celebration. And I had only just begun to listen. Chapter 8. Curaçao. The color beneath the water. Curaçao taught me something I didn't expect, that a nation can remember through water. Not just the sea that brought the Dutch, the Spaniards, the enslaved, but the reefs that hold color like history, the freshwater springs where communities still gather, the baptismal pools, the rainwater drums, the glassy blue that sits silently at the edge of every Curaçaoan memory. In part one, I had traced the island's colonial bones and its indigenous echoes, stories etched in architecture, cuisine, and stone. But in part two, I turned to the things that moved: water, language, ritual, and resistance disguised as celebration. Because on Curaçao, joy is not distraction, it's defiance. Jan Thiel, Leisure with a Local Pulse. The southern curve of the island is often promoted for its upscale beaches, and Jan Thiel is the poster child: lounge beds, crisp rosé, infinity views. But beneath the polished surface, I found a quieter story. One told in Creole murmurs, in the sunrise swims of older women, in the stone fisherman's chapel hidden behind the parking lot. I met Clara, a retired schoolteacher who swims laps at dawn every day. She pointed to the sea and said, "My grandmother used to scrub laundry on those rocks. Now I exercise where she survived." We walked together along the shoreline. The beach may have rebranded itself for Europeans, but for locals like Clara, it remained a living archive. "Don't let the bikinis fool you," she whispered. "This place still knows our names." Underwater reefs, stories without sound. Curaçao is one of the best diving destinations in the Caribbean, but I wasn't after adrenaline. I wanted stories. At a dive center near Tugboat Beach, I met Mateo, a third-generation diver and marine biologist. He fitted me with a mask, handed me a slate and pencil, and said, "Down there, everything is old, but it still glows." We descended slowly into turquoise, past rusted anchors, past colonies of brain coral that looked like sculpture. Schools of blue tang shimmered past, movement like synchronized memory. At 30 feet, we reached a sunken tugboat, encrusted in reef. I touched the hull, and it felt warm, alive with soft coral, algae, and thyme. Later, back on land, Mateo told me, "We plant coral here. It's our quiet revolution. While the world burns, we regrow." The diaspora return, art as reclamation. Downtown Willemstad is now home to a series of public murals, bold, Afro-futuristic, searing with color and commentary. Many are by diaspora artists who returned to reconnect with their heritage. One mural stopped me cold. A black woman with a crown of coral, her eyes closed, holding a scroll that unraveled into the sea. Around her, Dutch ships sinking into blue flames. The artist, Dayanara, was touching up the edge when I arrived. She wore paint-stained jeans and a top that read, "Colonial Ghosts Can't Swim." She told me she was born in Rotterdam, but came back to Curaçao to paint the silence out. "Our parents didn't talk about what happened," she said, "so now we color it loud." Tumba Festival, Carnival's musical cousin. I was lucky to arrive during Tumba Festival, Curaçao's own rhythmic rite held just before Carnival. Tumba isn't just music, it's public testimony set to drums. Singers perform songs, political, comedic, personal, in papiamentu, judged not just for melody, but message. One performer, a man called Debo D, sang about rising food prices, police corruption, and the price of forgetting one's roots. The crowd roared. The judges smiled. "It's protest you can dance to," someone next to me shouted. This is what makes Curaçao distinct. Not the presence of struggle, but its creative transformation into collective release. Landhouses and contrasts. Colonial estates reclaimed. Throughout the island, former Dutch landhuizen, plantation estates, still stand, their pastel walls chipped by salt and time. Many have been reclaimed as art galleries, community centers, or museums. I visited Landhuis Bloemhof, now home to installations by Curaçaoan women artists. One exhibit featured dresses made of rope, glass, and barbed wire. Another, a long table set with ceramic plates etched with slave names. The curator, Lisette, said, "We don't destroy these houses, we make them ours. That's our power." As we walked through the garden, I realized Curaçao doesn't seek erasure. It seeks recontextualization. Folk healing and the water women. In the hills outside Barber, I met Rosa, a herbalist who still gathers plants the way her grandmother did, early, barefoot, and with whispered thanks to the soil. She showed me her tin basin filled with blue vervain, lemongrass, and something called yerba de jole, a leaf used in both love spells and stomach aches. "We wash babies in this," she said. "We anoint the dead. We carry it in our pockets when we walk alone." She called herself a water woman, part of a quiet lineage of healers who trace back to West Africa through Suriname and Curaçao. "Our ancestors had no hospitals," she said, "just hands and memory." Cuisine as continuum, the backyard table. On my final night, I was invited to a backyard dinner in Santa Rosa, hosted by a multi-generational family who'd heard about my project. We ate stoba, goat stew, with funchi, drank agua de la munchi, and laughed over stories told half in papiamentu, half in gesture. The family matriarch, Auntie Dahlia, wore a white head wrap and grilled eggplant on open coals. "I don't cook for flavor," she told me. "I cook for connection." Each dish came with an origin story. Some oral, some invented, all sacred. As I bit into a spiced plantain croquette, I thought, the whole island is like this. Sweet, fiery, layered, and served best from a humble plate. Where to stay? Curaçao. Cultural and community focused. Artistic immersion. Barrio Hotel. Community run in Otrobanda. Mural-lined streets. Approximately $130 per night. Eco Boutique, Mondi Lodge, Garden Cabanas, Local Materials, Water Reuse Systems, approximately $145 per night. Rural Spiritual Stay, Sean de la Man Guesthouse, near Barber, nature-focused, access to herbalist tours, approximately $95 per night. Things to do. Curaçao, Part 2, Living Culture. Attend Tumba Festival or other music political events. Explore murals in Pietermaritzburg and Otrobanda. Visit a reclaimed landhuis turned into a gallery. Snorkel or dive at Tugboat Beach and engage in reef restoration. Join a traditional backyard meal or herbal walk in Santa Rosa or Barber. Participate in or witness a folk healing ceremony, if invited. Budget snapshot, Curaçao, 3 days community-centered. Lodging $160. Local dining and events $80. Cultural excursions $55. Transport $65. Total approximately $360. Final reflection. Curaçao is more than a jewel in the Dutch crown. It's a living poem in four languages, etched across land, reef, mural, and plate. Its people don't erase the past. They dance around it, paint over it, dive beneath it, cook it into every Sunday stew. In Curaçao, water holds memory, and art makes sure we don't drown in forgetting. I left with salt in my shoes, paint on my notebook, and the deep knowing that culture here doesn't perform. It pulses. Chapter 9, Granada. The revolution that still breathes. The scent hit me before the plane wheels kissed the tarmac. Nutmeg, cinnamon, and something else. Maybe bay leaf, maybe fire. Granada's airport bears the name Maurice Bishop, and for good reason. The moment you land, the island feels less like a getaway and more like a whisper from history. Ask about the revolution. And so I did. Because Granada, this small, fertile, mountainous jewel, holds more than beaches. It holds scars, it holds triumph, and it holds the uneasy, beautiful truth of what happens when a people try to rewrite their destiny with their own hands. First steps in St. George's, the capital with secrets in its stones. St. George's looks like a painting of a harbour town, rainbow-coloured buildings folded into hills, church steeples rising above market chatter, and fishing boats anchored like punctuation marks. But history lives in the cracks. I began at the Granada National Museum, housed inside a former French barracks. A young archivist named Ansel met me at the entrance, his lanyard decorated with a tiny black power fist. He led me to the exhibit on the 1979 to 1983 revolution, a movement born from labor strikes and island-wide frustration. Photos of Maurice Bishop hung beside typewritten manifestos and protest banners that once draped buildings like battle flags. He wanted literacy, land reform, dignity, Ansel said. He also wanted autonomy from America. That was the problem. I stood staring at a bullet-pierced chair. Was that his? I asked. No, Ansel replied, but it might as well have been. Everyone got pierced. Fort George. Looking out from a place that looked down the barrel. From the top of Fort George, the view is sublime. The entire harbour curls beneath you, framed by volcanic ridges and red-roofed homes. But in 1983, this wasn't just a view. It was a perch for executioners. I stood where Maurice Bishop and several of his cabinet were executed after an internal coup within his own revolutionary party. No official memorial marks the spot. Just faded paint, old stone, and heavy air. Locals pass through on tours, rarely lingering. My guide, Cynthia, simply said, "We don't all agree on what happened." but we all feel it. I asked why there was no plaque. Because the wound's not healed, she said, and maybe it shouldn't be. Market day, spices as memory, not just economy. At the St. George's Market, I met Auntie Verona, a spice vendor with calloused fingers and a laugh like wind chimes. Her stand overflowed with nutmeg, the island's most famous export, still called black gold. Mace, its fiery orange cousin. Cocoa balls, grated into thick island-style chocolate. And small brown bottles labeled tonic, that smelled faintly of clove and iron. Nutmeg brought the British, she said, handing me a sachet. And it brought war. But we don't throw it away. We make it sweet again. Each stall was a page from a colonial ledger rewritten by hands that now owned the narrative. Dougaldston Estate, walking through the plantation's ghost. A short drive inland led me to Dougaldston Estate, once one of Grenada's largest nutmeg and cocoa plantations. It's still operational, in fragments, but the estate's main house is cracked and silent. I wandered through drying sheds where racks of nutmeg still rested in sunlit rows. My host, Ezra, was part tour guide, part historian, part grandson of field laborers. Back then, everything smelled like sugar and silence, he said. He showed me a wall marked with whip scars. For discipline, a former owner once wrote. We stood in the shade of a mango tree planted by Ezra's grandmother after emancipation. She said it would bear sweetness to outlive bitterness. It still does. Grand Etang Lake, the island's breath. At Grenada's mountainous center sits Grand Etang, a crater lake wrapped in dense rainforest. Locals say the lake is bottomless. Scientists say it's not. But I trust the locals. At the water's edge, I met a group of elders conducting a drumming circle. They were part of a Maroon revival group, descendants of escaped enslaved Africans who preserved their rituals in Grenada's highlands. They let me sit in silence. No interviews, no photos, just rhythm and wind. Later, a woman named Mavis said, "This island doesn't just grow nutmeg, it grows memory, and it demands you respect both." Where to stay? Grenada, history and nature immersion. Budget option, Seabreeze Hotel, St. George's. Modest comfort, walking distance to market, approximately $75 per night. Cultural experience, Petite Anse Hotel, Sauteur. Locally owned, views of Carriacou, community-based activities, approximately $150 per night. Eco Retreat. Belmont Estate Cottages. Stay on a working cacao farm. Tours included, approximately $135 per night. Things to do. Grenada, Part 1. History and Land. Visit the Grenada National Museum to understand the revolution. Climb Fort George and ask what's not marked. Explore Dougaldston Estate and speak with descendants. Shop at St. George's Market with curiosity and respect. Take a day trip to Grand Etang Lake for nature and Maroon history. Learn about the Spice Island's troubled and triumphant journey. Budget snapshot. Grenada, 3 days, historical focus. Lodging, $225. Entry fees and tips, $30. Food and snacks, $60. Transport, $50. Total approximately $365. Final reflection. Grenada doesn't ask for pity. It asks for clarity. To walk its streets is to walk a line between freedom and fracture, between market stalls and firing squads, between nutmeg and blood. This island doesn't hide its pain. It carries it gracefully, like a queen wearing a crown she forged herself. And even in silence, you'll hear her say, "Remember me entirely." Chapter 10. Granada, where the sea feeds the soul. Exploratory Smithsonian style. First-person cultural documentarian. AI narration optimized. No. Granada's past is carved into its hills, but its present. It swims in the sea. It sizzles in iron pots. It speaks through children selling mangoes on roadside corners and teenagers draped in their own version of island swag. Part one had led me through rebellion and revolution, but for part two, I wanted to explore the living, breathing Granada, the one not always found in textbooks, but always present at the dinner table, in coral coves, or on the lip of a market stall. This is the Granada that feeds its people, literally and spiritually. Guyav, the town that fishes back. Locals call Guyav the action town, and they're not lying. On a Friday night, the entire village turns into a festival, grills sizzling with mahi-mahi, stingray and snapper, rum stalls alive with shouting and laughter, teenagers dancing barefoot in alleyways while elders nod along from porches. But Guyav isn't just a party town. It's the fishing capital of Granada. By day, I joined a crew prepping their pirogue for a dawn launch. Captain Kwame, mid-40s and sun-scorched, told me they still fish with hand lines and use natural bait. No trawlers, no overkill. "The sea gives, but she watches," he said. "You take too much, she'll remind you." Nutmeg Factory, the spice that shapes the island. Even after the revolution, nutmeg remains king. I visited the Guyav Nutmeg Processing Station, where women, called crackers, sit sorting the dried fruit into various grades. Their hands moved with a grace that comes from doing something ancestral. Each seed was held, turned, judged. My guide, Benice, told me Granada once supplied 20% of the world's nutmeg, until Hurricane Ivan decimated the industry in 2004. "We rebuilt with what little we had," she said, "because nutmeg isn't just income, it's identity." One worker tapped the table and added, "Tell your people, we are not just a beach." Belmont Estate, the farm as philosophy. Up in the northeast, I spent a full day at Belmont Estate, a historic cocoa farm turned agro-tourism hub. I took the full tour, walked past rows of cacao trees, tasted raw cacao beans, bitter, alive, crushed spices in a mortar with a seventh-generation Grenadian farmer, ate goat curry with Christophine, and fried plantains under a breadfruit tree. The estate also employs former factory workers and offers internships for local teens. I spoke with the director, a soft-spoken woman named Chadelle, who said, "Food can be political. If we grow our own, we're less dependent. That's freedom." River Antoine Rum Distillery, liquid time travel. Nothing prepares you for this place. River Antoine still uses a water wheel from the 1800s to crush cane. The boiling house runs on firewood. The fermentation tanks are open, moss-covered, and filled with bubbling future. The rum? Strong enough to erase the week? Tour guide Winston, who'd worked there 32 years, handed me a shot and said, "This ain't for cocktails. This is for ceremony." He told me villagers still use it for baptisms, funerals, and offerings to ancestors. Drink it fast, but respect it slow. I did. Art, youth, and the new Grenadian voice. In St. George's, I wandered into a storefront studio, run by a youth collective called Island Real. Spray-painted murals of revolutionaries mixed with abstract seascapes. One piece showed a barefoot boy holding a nutmeg grenade, his face half in shadow. I met Karim, 19, who said, "We're tired of tourists coming for sun and ignoring our struggle." He told me about their workshops for kids, public art campaigns, and new podcast covering everything from black identity to post-hurricane trauma. "Granada's not stuck in the past," he said. "We're shaping the next page, in our voice." Kariakou, the island within the island nation. Granada is technically a tri-island state. Granada, Kariakou, and Petite Martinique. I took a ferry to Kariakou, the largest of the two sisters. There, the energy softened. Fewer cars, slower time, deeper smiles. I visited a boat-building village where traditional sloops are still crafted by hand. One elder, Jonas, said, "No blueprints, just memory." The island holds an annual maroon and string band festival, a fusion of African rhythms and European fiddle traditions. "We're not leftovers," said a young dancer named Afia. "We're braided history." Grenadian cuisine, a resistance through flavor. Grenadian food is not just delicious, it's declarative. Here's what I tasted across 5 days. Oil down, the national dish, stewed in coconut milk with breadfruit, dumplings, salted meat, turmeric, and saffron. Callaloo soup, green, thick, peppery, and healing. Bakes and saltfish, breakfast with memory. Sarrel drink, hibiscus, with ginger and cloves. Golden apple chow, tart, spicy, addictive. Each meal was accompanied by stories, often about grandmothers, hurricanes, or carnival. As one cook told me, you can erase a law, but you can't unlearn taste. Where to stay? Granada, culture, community, and food. Food-focused farm. Stay, True Blue Bay, boutique resort, eco-conscious cooking classes near St. George's, approximately $180 per night. Heritage Lodge, Mount Edgecombe. Plantation Hotel, historic site turned in. Spice Trails nearby, approximately $140 per night. Local guest house, Casa de Solomon, Kariakou. Quiet, culturally immersed, approximately $95 per night. Things to do. Granada. Part 2. Living Identity. Join a Friday fish fry in Guyave. Tour the River Antoine Rum Distillery. Spend a day at Belmont Estate. Spice Walk. Cocoa Tasting. Meet youth artists in St. George's at Island Real. Ferry to Kariakou to explore indigenous and African traditions. Attend a cooking class and make your own oil down. Budget snapshot. Granada. 3 days. Cultural focus. Lodging, $270. Cultural activities, $85. Food and drinks, $90. Transport, $65. Total approximately $510. Final reflection. Granada doesn't perform for you. It cooks for you. It drums, ferments, sweats, and prays for you. And if you're lucky, you'll be invited to sit close to the flame. To know this island is to eat your way through its rebellion. to drink its ancestry from a rusted still, to hear a teenager remix history in spray paint. In Granada, culture isn't a museum piece. It's lunch, it's laughter, it's the sea, feeding the soul. Chapter 11, Trinidad and Tobago, The Spirit of Carnival. You don't just witness carnival in Trinidad, you enter it. It doesn't wait for you to arrive. It surrounds you. It swallows you whole. I landed in Port of Spain 3 weeks before Carnival Monday. Still, it felt like I was already late. Baselines thumped from taxis. Feathers shimmered from storefront mannequins. Children practiced dance steps in schoolyards. Carnival here isn't a performance. It's a declaration. We survived. We transformed. Now, we celebrate. And behind every sequin and soccer beat is something older, deeper. A cultural fusion forged in fire and masquerade. Port of Spain, the pulse before the parade. From my hotel window, I could see the Queen's Park Savannah, the heartbeat of Trinidad Carnival. In the early morning, runners circled its rim. By afternoon, sound trucks rehearsed with stacks of speakers as tall as trees. I wandered through the grandstand, still half constructed, where vendors were already reserving spots. There were roti stalls, coconut water carts, and one artist sketching moko jumbis, the towering stilt walkers that roam carnival streets like ancestral guardians. A man selling fullery with tamarind sauce grinned when he saw my recorder. "You here for the wine or the why?" he asked. "Both," I said. He laughed. "Then you'll need good shoes and an open mind." The Maz Camp, stitching resistance into costume. I spent a full afternoon at the Legacy Mass Camp, one of Trinidad's iconic masquerade bands. Inside, it smelled of glue, glitter, and raw ambition. Dozens of young women stitched sequins into bodysuits. Men welded aluminum wire into wings. Elder women organized feathers by hue. The theme this year, Return of the River Spirits. I sat with founder Brian McFarlane, a designer turned storyteller. "Maz isn't just beauty," he said. "It's rebellion in disguise." He explained how carnival originated during French colonial rule, when the enslaved were banned from festivities, so they created their own, mocking their masters through mimicry and masks. "Pretty Mass," he told me, "grew from pain mass." Never forget that. Jouvert, dancing with the ancestors in the dark. At 4 a.m. on Carnival Monday, I walked into the oily chaos of Jouvert. People covered in blue paint, motor oil, chocolate, and mud danced through the streets like possessed shadows. Drums pounded, steel pans clanged. The city pulsed in primal rhythm. One woman, her face smeared with red clay, grabbed my hand. "This is how we start. In the dark, from the earth, from the body," she said. "Carnival is birth." Jouvert is wild, but it's not careless. It's ritual. Participants play roles. Devils, Jab Molassi, Blue Devils, and Dame Lorraine. Each character holds historical meaning. Plantation satire, African deities, colonial ridicule, sexual defiance. Here, carnival becomes an archive you wear. Panyard. The drum became our voice. Later that week, I visited the Desperados Steel Orchestra Panyard. Steel pan, I quickly learned, isn't just Trinidad's national instrument, it's the world's only acoustic instrument invented in the 20th century. Born in Laventille, in the belly of urban resistance, the pan was first made from oil drums after colonial laws banned African drumming. Today, entire communities gather in panyards to practice for panorama. the steel pan competition held during carnival season. The sound was hypnotic. 40 pans in sync. Sweaty brows, focused joy. I asked one teenage player, Keon, what the pan meant to him. He shrugged and smiled. Everything. Kaiso and soccer, the lyric and the rhythm. To understand carnival, you have to understand its two musical lifelines, calypso, kaiso, and soca. I sat in on a rehearsal for the Calypso Monarch competition, where sharp-tongued singers use wit and rhyme to tackle everything from corruption to carnival bans. One performer, Lady Flame, sang, "They raise tax but drop the wine. Still want to censor we waistline." I laughed. The crowd roared, but behind the humor was a protest. Then came soccer, the sonic blood of carnival. It's faster, body-driven, bass-heavy. I met Naila Blackman, granddaughter of soccer's inventor, Lord Shorty. "Soccer is celebration," she told me, "but it's ours, born here, from us." Where to stay? Trinidad. Carnival immersion. Budget option. Woodbrook City Suites. Walkable to carnival hubs. Lively neighborhood. Approximately $85 per night. Local guest house. Pariah Suites. San Fernando. For a quieter stay with local vibes. Approximately $100 per night. Luxury carnival experience. Hyatt Regency Trinidad. Downtown waterfront. Host to many mass band events, approximately $320 per night. Things to do. Trinidad, Part 1, Carnival and Culture. Join a mass camp tour and watch costumes come to life. Experience Jouvert, but be ready to get dirty. Visit a pan yard for a steel pan rehearsal. Attend Calypso Monarch semifinals or Soca Monarch Finals. Explore Carnival Institute of Trinidad and Tobago. Interview a designer, dancer, or steel pan player. Budget snapshot. Trinidad. Carnival season. 3 days. Lodging, $255. Event access and tours, $75. Food and drinks, $90. Transport, $60. Total, approximately $480. Final reflection. Carnival in Trinidad isn't just a party. It's a weapon, a poem, a memory wrapped in feathers and bass. It is where African spiritualism, colonial satire, Indian rhythm, and French masquerade all collide and remix. Not into confusion, but into culture. By the time I left Port of Spain, I wasn't the same person who landed. Because here, celebration isn't distraction, it's resistance turned radiant. Chapter 12. Tobago, the island time forgot. If Trinidad is the drumbeat, Tobago is the echo, softer, slower, but just as deep. Flying in from Port of Spain, I could already feel the difference. Fewer buildings, more green. The air somehow moved differently. Not just slower, but wiser. Tobago doesn't yell. It hums. Locals call it the sleepy one. But I quickly learned that's only half true. Beneath the stillness is a living library of folk traditions, coastal rituals, and ecological reverence that survives not in museums, but in the rhythm of everyday life. Charlotteville, the village that faces the sea. I began my journey in Charlotteville, a crescent-shaped fishing village tucked into Tobago's northeastern coast. The hills here cradle the town like protective arms, and everything, the church, the school, the corner shop, faces the water. At sunrise, I followed three brothers out on their pirogue. They hauled in nets by hand, rhythmically chanting in patois, like their father did, and his before him. Back ashore, we grilled flying fish right on the sand. One brother, Jomo, handed me breadfruit roasted in foil. He looked out to the Atlantic and said, "We don't measure time here. We measure tide." Creole kitchens, where the old gods still simmer. I had lunch in a small open-air kitchen run by Miss Edlin, a woman with silver braids and a voice that could quiet storms. She served me curried crab and dumplings, Tobago's unofficial national dish, thick with coconut milk, turmeric, and garlic. "You can't rush this," she said, thumping a heavy pot. "It's spiritual food." Her kitchen walls were lined with herbs: basil, shadow benny, lemongrass, sour sop leaves. She spoke of bush teas that could cure everything from heartbreak to bad luck. I asked where she learned all this. "My great-grandmother. She was a midwife, healer, and rum runner." We both laughed, but it was clear. In Tobago, the past is still seasoning the pot. Baku Reef, dancing with coral. Tobago's relationship with the sea isn't just practical, it's sacred. I took a glass-bottom boat out to Buku Reef, one of the Caribbean's most treasured marine sanctuaries. As we floated over forests of staghorn coral and dancing blue tangs, the guide, Marlon, told us, "This reef feed we, protect we, school we children." We anchored near Nylon Pool, a natural shallow sandbar in the middle of the sea. The water was so clear it looked fake. Locals say it grants eternal youth. I didn't test the theory, but I did notice how everyone there, even the elders, seemed to be smiling like children. Folklore and the Midnight Road. That night, in the village of Bethel, I was invited to a storytelling circle. We sat under a silk cotton tree while lanterns cast slow shadows. One man, Jerome, told tales of Papa Bois, the forest protector with goat legs and human eyes. Another sang a song about La Diablesse, the demon woman with one cow hoof. I noticed the stories weren't just spooky. They taught boundaries. Between greed and gratitude, between curiosity and caution. A teenage girl stood up and whispered, "This is how Tobago teaches. We use myth. We scare you smart." Ecotourism and the quiet revolution. Tobago isn't trying to be the next Cancun, and that's intentional. At Adventure Eco Villas, I met a couple who'd built their treehouse lodge with local timber, solar panels, and rainwater catchments. Their staff were all from the nearby community. They offered birdwatching tours, waterfall hikes, and turtle-hatching nights. "People come here expecting resort luxury," the owner said, "but they leave with stories about a turtle, a breadfruit, or a dance under moonlight." In the village of Castara, I visited a school that teaches sustainable fishing. One boy showed me a fish trap made from bamboo and chicken wire. "No plastic," he said proudly. Where to stay? Tobago. Slow travel. Real roots. Eco-retreat. Adventure. Eco-villas. Arnos Vale, surrounded by forest. Breakfast included. Approximately $135 per night. Seaside Guest House, Footprints Eco Resort, Culloden Bay, beachfront, sustainable, hammocks with ocean views, approximately $125 per night. Heritage Stay, the Naturalist Beach Resort, Castara, run by local family, simple charm, approximately $100 per night. Things to do. Tobago. Part 2, Folklore and Flow. go fishing with a local crew in Charlottesville, dine at a roadside stand and try crab and dumplings, snorkel at Buckhoo Reef or wade in Nylon Pool, attend a nighttime storytelling circle or folklore show, visit the Tubago Cocoa Estate and taste bean-to-bar chocolate, book a bird-watching hike through Main Ridge Forest Reserve, the oldest protected rainforest in the Western Hemisphere. Budget snapshot. Tubago. 3 days. Local immersion. Lodging, $270. Cultural activities, $80. Food and drinks, $90. Transport, $55. Total approximately $495. Final reflection. Tubago is the Caribbean without the chase. No high-rise skylines, no mega-cruise ports, just people who know how to sit with time. It taught me that culture isn't always loud. Sometimes it hums through breadfruit fires, whispers through old stories, and lingers in coral shallows. In Tubago, you don't escape the world. You remember how it was meant to feel. Chapter 13. Antigua. The forts that watched empires fall. Some islands whisper their history. Antigua broadcasts it from every hilltop. It was my first day on the island when I noticed something unusual. Ruins everywhere. Forts, barracks, stone watchtowers peeking over turquoise bays. But this wasn't a place frozen in time. It was a place where time collapsed, brick by colonial brick, into a story of freedom, endurance, and identity. To understand Antigua, I had to listen to its hills, its harbors, and the silence of men who once stood watch for ships that would decide their fate. Shirley Heights, a fortress of perspectives. My first stop was Shirley Heights, the most iconic lookout point on the island. As I climbed the stone steps of the old British military complex, the Caribbean spread out before me like an open wound and a celebration at once. This was no ordinary view. This was strategy. From here, British officers once scanned the horizon for French ships during the Napoleonic Wars. Their cannons still rest like sleeping sentinels among the bougainvillea. I arrived at sunset, when the site transforms into a lively gathering of locals and visitors. Steel pan music echoed off the cliffs. Grilled jerk chicken perfumed the air. But I kept drifting back to the contrast, this vibrant joy built atop a site of surveillance and control. One woman selling rum punch leaned in and said, "You see fun." But this was war. Always was. Nelson's Dockyard, Empire in the Harbour. Down at English Harbour, I walked into a fully restored Georgian naval yard, the only one of its kind still in use. It felt like I had wandered into a Jane Austen novel, only the characters were colonizers and slaves. Named after Admiral Horatio Nelson, who served here in the 1780s, the dockyard was once the nerve center of the Royal Navy's Caribbean power. Now it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, lined with yachts and restored stone warehouses. But the real story was in the back rooms, where enslaved Africans built the infrastructure, repaired ships, and endured brutal labor, all for a crown they'd never see. I met a local historian, Judith, who guided me past the glossy exhibits. She pointed to a rusted anchor in the grass. "That wasn't just dropped in the sea," she said. "That was dropped on someone's back." Liberta, the village that named itself. After the abolition of slavery in 1834, many newly freed people settled inland, away from the plantations and ports. They created the village of Liberta, named not by government decree, but by the people themselves. I drove inland and walked its hilly streets, lined with wooden homes and mango trees. I met an elder named Mr. Tannis, who sat outside a yellow house shelling pigeon peas. He told me how his grandfather helped build the church down the road, and how every child here grows up knowing one thing. We name we self. We chose free. That's what liberta mean. Devil's Bridge, where salt meets spirit. On the eastern edge of Antigua, I visited Devil's Bridge, a natural limestone arch shaped by centuries of crashing waves. The name is misleading. It's not about evil. It's about desperation. Legend says enslaved people jumped to their deaths here, seeking freedom from brutal sugar estates nearby. I stood there, salt spray in my face, the Atlantic roaring beneath my feet, and felt a weight that had nothing to do with gravity. Some say the bridge cries at night. Some say it whispers names. I say it remembers. Food with a story, from dockside to farmland. Antigua's cuisine is shaped by its maritime heritage and subsistence roots. At a beachside shack near Runaway Bay, I tasted Dukana, a sweet dumpling of grated sweet potato, coconut, and spices, wrapped in banana leaf. Served with salted cod and pepper sauce, it was a collision of Africa, Europe, and the sea. At a roadside stand in All Saints, I tried fungi and pepper pot, the national dish, a cornmeal mash served with a dark, rich stew of greens and pork. "It's poor people food," the cook said, handing me a bowl. "But it powerful." Where to stay? Antigua, history meets horizon. Mid-range comfort. The Admiral's Inn, located in Nelson's Dockyard, restored 18th century building, harbor views, approximately $190 per night. Eco-luxury, South Point Antigua, modern suites with marina views, great for history and beach access, approximately $300 per night. Local guest house, Ocean Inn, English Harbor, cozy rooms, friendly staff, near historic sites. Approximately $120 per night. Things to do. Antigua. Part 1. History, Forts, and Freedom. Explore Shirley Heights during sunset for history and music. Visit Nelson's Dockyard Museum for naval history. Walk the Liberta Heritage Trail with a local guide. Stand at Devil's Bridge and learn its oral history. Taste Dukana and fungi from a roadside vendor. Join a guided fort tour through Fort James or Fort Barrington. Budget snapshot. Antigua. 3 days. History focused. Lodging $360. Activities and tours $85. Food and drinks $100. Transport $60. Total. Approximately $605. Final reflection. Antigua isn't a postcard. It's a palimpsest, layers of empire, resistance, reinvention. Its forts may be silent now, but they remember. Its people may smile, but they remember too. And in that remembering, in that refusal to forget, lies a deeper kind of freedom. Chapter 14, Barbuda. The island that rebuilt itself. Barbuda isn't just a place. It's a statement of survival. When Hurricane Irma tore across the island in 2017, it didn't just flatten homes. It unthreaded history. Every school, every church, every shop, gone in a night. The entire population was evacuated to Antigua. For months, Barbuda was empty, silent. Many said it would never recover. But they underestimated the people who call this quiet pink sand island home. Coco Point, where the sand turns to memory. I arrived at Coco Point, where the beach stretches in a perfect arc, as if carved by careful hands. The sand here isn't white, it's blush, soft pink, under sunlight. Locals say it's from the crushed shells of tiny coral creatures. The new boutique eco-resorts looked pristine, but when I spoke to local builder Desmond, he pointed to the coconut trees behind the property. That's where the school was. Before Irma. He paused. We don't just rebuild walls. We rebuild memory. The return. Stories of those who came back. In Codrington, Barbuda's only town, the streets buzz with generators and laughter. Life is being put back together like patchwork, roof by roof, handshake by handshake. I sat outside the rebuilt Holy Trinity School, where teachers held class under tents for years after the storm. I met Marita, a nurse who returned to reopen the clinic. I didn't have electricity for 18 months, she said, boiling bush tea on a coal pot. But we came back, because this is home. The Frigate Bird Sanctuary. Wings of Resilience. Barbuda is home to the largest frigate bird sanctuary in the Western Hemisphere, a surreal mangrove lagoon filled with over 5,000 birds, many with balloon-like red chests puffed during mating season. After Irma, many feared the birds were lost. But when the waters calmed, the birds returned, just like the Barbudans. I took a small boat with a guide named Raymond, who grew up navigating the maze of trees and brackish water. See them? He pointed to the sky, where hundreds of frigate birds wheeled overhead. They knew this place before GPS. Eco-conservation and the fight for land. One of the fiercest battles in Barbuda isn't against storms. It's over who owns the land. Traditionally, all land in Barbuda was held communally. After the hurricane, foreign investors eyed the vacant terrain, pushing for resorts, golf courses, private ownership. Local activist Tariq told me, they see pink sand. We see ancestors. Barbudans resisted. They fought in court. They held town halls. They blocked bulldozers. In a world selling paradise by the acre, Barbuda dared to say, this land is not for sale. Sacred simplicity. A way of life. Worth defending. Life in Barbuda isn't glamorous. There are no mega malls, no cruise ports, but there's something more valuable. Peace. I spent a morning at Two Foot Bay, exploring limestone caves where Amerindian drawings still adorn the stone. That afternoon, I shared grilled snapper and cassava pone with a family who invited me in, just because it was lunchtime. Barbuda reminded me that the Caribbean isn't just beaches, it's belief, in place, in people, in continuity. Where to stay? Barbuda, off-grid and reclaimed. Echo Boutique. Barbuda Bell. Solar-powered beachfront villas. Locally staffed, approximately $420 per night. Guesthouse. Frangipani Glamping, Codrington, basic but soulful, near lagoon, approximately $90 per night. Homestay, community lodging initiative, various homes, cultural immersion, approximately $65 per night. Things to do, Barbuda. Part 2, Nature and Rebirth. Tour the Frigate Bird Sanctuary by boat. Visit the Barbuda Museum to understand communal land fights. Explore the Indian cave paintings at Two Foot Bay. Relax on Princess Diana Beach, named for her secret visits. Learn from local builders and activists about post-Irma rebuilding. Dine on fresh lobster, caught and grilled by the fisherfolk. Budget Snapshot, Barbuda, 3 days, conscious travel. Lodging, $270. Eco tours and museums, $85. Food and drinks, $90. Transport, $65. Total, approximately, $510. Final reflection. Barbuda taught me that resilience isn't loud. It doesn't wave banners or post selfies. It shows up in reopened schools, returned birds, and stubborn belief in ancestral land. It's the kind of island that could vanish on a map and still survive in memory. And maybe that's the most Caribbean thing of all. Chapter 15. Dominican Republic, Colonial Echoes and City Rhythms. You don't just walk into Santo Domingo. You enter a living archive. It's the oldest continuously inhabited European established city in the Americas, a place where cobblestones remember, where colonial walls still stand, and where every street corner tells a story of conquest, culture, resistance, and rebirth. This chapter isn't about resorts or beaches, it's about the soul of the Dominican Republic, tucked inside this capital city's heartbeat, a fusion of Spanish stone, African rhythm, and Taino memory. Zona Colonial, a museum without a roof. I began in the Zona Colonial, a UNESCO World Heritage Site that feels like a living, breathing movie set, but with deeper scars. Founded in 1496 by Bartholomew Columbus, brother of Christopher, the area is home to the first cathedral, first paved roads, and first European fortress in the New World. I stood in front of Alcázar de Colón, the former mansion of Diego Columbus, and felt a strange shiver. Here was the architectural symbol of European rule, built on the backs of enslaved Africans and decimated Taino laborers. But Santo Domingo has reclaimed its rhythm. The fortress now shares a plaza with domino players, poets, and wandering troubadours. One old man playing guitar near the steps looked up and said, "Colón had gold. We have soul." Cathedral of Santa Maria la Menor, stones that preach. I stepped into the Cathedral of Santa Maria la Menor, the oldest cathedral in the Americas. The vaulted ceilings soared like ambition. The air was thick with incense and centuries of quiet reverence. But beneath its solemn grandeur, I kept thinking about the people who never entered through the front door. The ones who mixed the mortar, heaved the stone, built this sanctuary while forbidden to pray inside. As I lit a candle, I thought not of saints, but of survival. Afro-Caribbean identity, beyond the walls. To understand the Dominican Republic's heart, I had to leave the old stones and step into Villamella, a district north of the city, known for its strong Afro-Dominican traditions. Here, I met Don Luis, a spiritual leader and drummer in the Cofradía del Espíritu Santo, a brotherhood preserving African-rooted religious and musical customs since colonial times. He showed me their sacred drums, carved from ceiba wood and goatskin. Then he played. The rhythm was hypnotic, ancestral, like thunder with memory. "This is not music," he said. "This is communication with the past, with the spirits, with our people." The Museum of the Dominican Man, Fractured Narratives. Inside the Museo del Hombre Dominicano, I wandered through glass cases filled with Taino artifacts, petroglyphs, stone tools, and ceremonial objects from the island's original inhabitants. The silence in the room was thick. While the museum preserves pre-Columbian memory, it also feels like a eulogy. The Taino were nearly erased by colonization, disease, and systemic destruction. But their language lives on in Dominican speech. Words like hurricane, barbecue, and canoe. Linguistic ghosts. I sat under a carved wooden idol and asked myself, how does a nation carry a memory it tried to forget? Food as cultural memory, from sancocho to street snacks. Dominican food is a fusion of histories, Taino roots, African survival, Spanish adaptation. In a busy open-air market near Avenida Duarte, I tasted mangu, mashed green plantains topped with red onions. Chimichurri, a greasy, addictive street burger with Dominican flair. Sancocho, a seven-meat stew said to cure everything from heartbreak to hangovers. A vendor named Leticia smiled as I finished my plate. Food is the only history that hugs you. Where to stay? Santo Domingo, History and Humanity. Colonial Boutique, Bellini Hotel. Located inside a restored 16th century convent, rooftop pool, approximately $230 per night. Cultural Midrange, Casa Sanchez. Adults only boutique near major sites, classic interior patios, approximately $120 per night. Budget Charm, El Beaterio Casa Museo. Former convent, now a cozy stay, $80 per night. Things to do. Dominican Republic, Part 1, Cultural Core. Walk through Zona Colonial and visit the Alcazar de Colón. Attend a cofradía performance in Villamelia, especially during religious festivals. Visit the Museo del Hombre Dominicano to explore Taino and African heritage. Eat traditional dishes at Mercado Modelo or street-side stalls. Light a candle in the Santa Maria Cathedral and listen to the echoes. Walk along El Conde, the city's famous pedestrian street filled with artists and storytellers. Budget snapshot, Santo Domingo, 3 days, culture-focused. Lodging $240, cultural tours $60, food and drinks $95, transport $55, total approximately $450. Final reflection. Santo Domingo is not just the beginning of Caribbean colonization, it's the beginning of Caribbean resistance. It's a place where centuries of pain have fermented into poetry, where drums speak louder than cathedrals, and where identity isn't singular, it's syncretic, layered, alive. In its streets, I found not just history, but transformation. Chapter 16. Dominican Republic. Mountains, music, and the soul of the Campo. To truly know the Dominican Republic, you must leave Santo Domingo behind and climb upward, beyond crowded streets and colonial churches, into mountains wrapped in mist and memory. The Campo, Dominican countryside, isn't just landscape, it's legacy. Here, communities live in rhythm with coffee harvests and river tides, their days punctuated not by clocks, but by merengue, beats, and bachata guitar strings. I came to the mountains, seeking a quieter story, one told in soil, song, and the patient work of hands that never make headlines, but always make history. Jarabacoa, town of eternal spring. My journey began in Jarabacoa, nestled in the lush Cordillera Central Mountains. Locals call it La Ciudad de la Eterna Primavera, the city of eternal spring. Here, the air was crisp and fresh, the horizon ringed by green peaks. I arrived at sunrise, when farmers moved quietly through fields, collecting coffee cherries and strawberries. Every face I passed greeted me. Buen dia. No rush, no suspicion. Just slow, genuine welcome. I sat with Carmen, a local coffee farmer, as she roasted beans over a wood fire. Her movements were rhythmic, effortless. We're not rushing anything here, she told me. Coffee takes patience. Life, too. Music as daily bread. Merengue and bachata. In the campo, music is everywhere, drifting from houses, roadside stands, even buses. I visited a tiny colmado, a local convenience shop, in Jarabacoa, where locals gathered at sunset. A small radio played merengue, its rapid rhythm bouncing off wooden walls. Soon, feet began tapping. Couples danced effortlessly on packed dirt floors. Music isn't entertainment, one older man explained. It's breathing. At a farmhouse further up the mountain, I met Jose, who built bachata guitars by hand. He strummed one gently, a bittersweet melody filling his simple workshop. Bachata is sadness and sweetness, he said. It's our story. Constanza, a mountain oasis. My next stop was Constanza, an even higher mountain town, known for its cool climate, fertile soils, and patchwork of vegetable fields. Farmers here supply fresh produce to much of the Caribbean, working small plots that cling stubbornly to mountainsides. I met Rosa, a farmer harvesting carrots on a terraced slope. She invited me to help, showing me how to pull gently so as not to break the delicate roots. We feed the island from here, she said proudly. Every carrot, every cabbage has sweat and heart in it. Community life, sharing as survival. Dominican campo life isn't just about agriculture. It's about interdependence. When hurricanes or floods strike, neighbors band together, pooling food, medicine, and labor. In El Rio, a tiny village outside Constanza, I witnessed this firsthand. A recent storm had washed out roads and crops, but the village was already recovering, rebuilding with quiet determination. I asked a community elder, Don Antonio, how they survived such hardship so regularly. He smiled warmly. We have no choice. Alone, we fall. Together, we rise. Sacred Waters, Salto de Jimenoa. Near Jarabacoa, I visited Salto de Jimenoa, a waterfall that plunges dramatically into a pool surrounded by dense jungle. Dominicans from all over the country travel here to bathe and pray. Some see it as sacred, others simply as refreshing. But all agree, it holds power. I watched as a family carefully entered the cold water, whispering prayers. The grandmother explained, "The mountain gives us water, food, life. This is how we say thank you." Agricultural wisdom, respect for land. Back at a family-run farm, I watched farmers practice sustainable agriculture, rotating crops, composting waste, planting companion plants to naturally repel pests. We don't need chemicals, a young farmer named Luis explained. Our grandparents farmed this way. They taught us, care for the land, and it will care for you. Cuisine of the campo. Simple, powerful food. Dominican mountain cuisine reflects life itself. Straightforward, nourishing, rooted in what the land provides. In a farmhouse kitchen near Constanza, a woman named Luz taught me to cook la bandera dominicana, rice, beans, meat, salad, and a hearty mountain stew called asopao, fragrant with cilantro and garlic. She served each dish proudly. Food from the earth is medicine, she told me. It heals more than hunger. where to stay. Dominican Campo, Mountain Retreats. Eco-friendly lodge. Rancho Baiguate, Jarabacoa, rustic cabins, eco-tours, approximately $100 per night. Mountain Guesthouse, Villa Pajon, Constanza, charming cottages, sustainable farm stay, approximately $95 per night. Budget. Farm stay. Cabaña, Los Bojios, near Jarabacoa, simple, authentic hospitality, approximately $65 per night. Things to do, Dominican Republic, Part 2, Mountain Life. Visit Jarabacoa coffee farms and taste freshly roasted beans. Dance merengue or bachata at a village colmado. Harvest vegetables in Constanza with local farmers. Bathe or hike at Salto de Jimenoa waterfall. Participate in a community rebuilding project or a farming cooperative. Take cooking lessons in traditional campo dishes like la bandera or a sopao. Budget snapshot, Dominican Campo, 3 days, authentic travel. Lodging $255, food and drinks $70, cultural activities $60, transport $55, total approximately $440. Final reflection. In the Dominican Mountains, I learned that life's greatest rhythms aren't rushed. They're savored, shared, and respected. From merengue dance floors to carrot fields, every moment was about connection. To land, to neighbors, to history itself. The campo taught me something vital. True wealth isn't measured in speed or success. It's measured in community, kindness, and music that refuses to fade. Chapter 17. St. Vincent and the Grenadines. The Fire and Spirit of Garifuna. St. Vincent and the Grenadines is not just one place, but many. Volcanic peaks, isolated caves, dense jungles, crystal-clear lagoons. But at its core, beyond postcard beaches, lies a culture born from defiance, resilience, and profound memory. I came seeking the Garifuna, the descendants of indigenous Arawak and Carib peoples who fused with Africans escaping slavery. They fiercely resisted European colonizers, surviving forced exile and attempted erasure. To know St. Vincent, you must first understand them. Kingstown, gateway to Garifuna. I started in Kingstown, St. Vincent's capital. Busy, colorful, colonial architecture blended with Caribbean vibrancy. Market stalls overflowed with bananas, coconuts, nutmeg, and ginger root. People moved quickly, dodging potholes and minibuses. At the St. Vincent Botanical Gardens, the oldest in the Western Hemisphere, my guide, Delroy, shared stories of the island's troubled colonial past. Amidst the lush foliage brought by colonizers was something indigenous, towering breadfruit trees, first introduced by Captain Bligh after his infamous bounty voyage. But Delroy spoke proudly of another story, the Garifuna. "We're not a vanished people," he said. "We're everywhere you look." La Soufriere, mountain of fire and freedom. The next morning, I hiked La Soufriere, St. Vincent's active volcano, recently erupted and still smoldering gently, a visible reminder of nature's raw power. My guide, Winston, a local historian, explained how volcanic eruptions have shaped not just the landscape, but the island's identity. After the 2021 eruption, the Garifuna communities, descendants of indigenous survivors, were instrumental in relief efforts. "We're people of volcanoes," Winston said. "We're shaped by fire, displacement, resilience. It's in our blood." As we reached the rim, I stared into the steaming crater and saw more than geology. I saw history itself. Explosive, unpredictable, transformative. Garifuna Village, Sandy Bay. In Sandy Bay, a northern village, the Garifuna legacy felt strongest. Small homes lined a quiet bay, fishing nets drying under palm trees. Children played cricket, laughing freely. I met an elder named Celestine, who invited me into her home. Photographs covered her walls. Ancestors in ceremonial clothing, grandchildren graduating from school. Every child learns our language, songs, dances, Celestine said proudly. They tried to erase us, but we still speak. She offered me traditional cassava bread, coarse, nourishing, deliciously simple. I tasted centuries of stubborn survival. Cultural preservation, drumming as resistance. That night, in Sandy Bay, I attended a drumming circle. Garifuna drums, carved from tree trunks and stretched with goatskin, resonated deeply. Men and women moved together, feet stomping in rhythm. A young drummer named Jamal explained, "These aren't just beats, they're memories. We drum to connect with ancestors, to teach younger generations that our strength survived." As the circle ended, a sense of sacredness lingered. Garifuna drumming isn't just music, it's resistance with rhythm, defiance through dance. Fort Charlotte, echoes of colonial struggle. Back in Kingstown, I visited Fort Charlotte, a British fort built to watch for enemies approaching by sea, but its cannons pointed inward, toward the land, toward the Garifuna and rebellious enslaved Africans. From its walls, I saw an island of contradictions, colonial violence, and indigenous resilience, conquest and freedom, past and present, tangled inseparably. My guide, Clarissa, summarized simply, "We don't destroy history, we live beyond it." Cuisine as cultural pride. In a small Kingstown cafe, I ate madongo dumplings, banana-based, kalalu soup, and grilled fish seasoned with local herbs. The chef Marlene explained each dish proudly. "Our food mixes Arawak roots, African resilience, Caribbean flavor. Every bite reminds you who we are." Where to stay? St. Vincent, culture and nature. Eco-friendly lodging. Richmond Vale, Nature Lodge, near La Soufrière, sustainable tourism, local guides, approximately $85 per night. Historic guest house, Grenadine House, Kingstown, colonial era building, authentic feel, approximately $120 per night. Local stay, community, homestay, Sandy Bay, Garifuna cultural immersion, family run, approximately $50 per night. Things to do, St. Vincent, Part 1, Heritage and Identity. Hike La Soufrière Volcano and learn its cultural symbolism. Visit Garifuna villages in Sandy Bay and speak with elders. Participate in a traditional Garifuna drumming ceremony. Explore Fort Charlotte for colonial perspectives and indigenous resistance. Learn Garifuna phrases from locals eager to share their culture. Eat traditional Garifuna dishes like cassava bread, madongo, and kalalu. Budget snapshot. St. Vincent, 3 days, culture-focused. Lodging $255, cultural activities $70, food and drinks $75, transport $60, total approximately $460. Final reflection. St. Vincent and the Grenadines reminded me that culture isn't fragile. It's volcanic, resilient, determined to thrive despite colonial violence and natural disasters. The Garifuna don't just live here. They resonate through every drumbeat, every word, every gesture of welcome. Their identity isn't found in textbooks. It's woven through the fabric of daily life. To know this place is to understand its people, their pain, and their persistent joy. In St. Vincent, survival isn't quiet. It drums, dances, and refuses to disappear. Chapter 18, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Sailing Through Paradise. If St. Vincent is volcanic strength and Garifuna spirit, then the Grenadines are whispers of turquoise tranquility, scattered like gems across endless blue. Yet beneath postcard views of sailing yachts and secluded beaches lies another narrative, a story of maritime traditions, island resilience, and fierce environmental stewardship. I journeyed through this archipelago to discover how small islands maintain identity, unity, and sustainability in the face of tourism and climate change. Bequia, Island of Boats. I began in Bequia, the second largest Grenadine island, where wooden boats are not just vessels, they're heritage. At Admiralty Bay, fishing boats and sleek yachts coexisted effortlessly. I walked to a small boatyard where traditional sloops were handcrafted, plank by plank, by local boat builders. I met Orville, a master boat builder in his 60s, sanding a freshly built boat. "We build boats like our fathers," he said. "Hand tools, no blueprints, just memory." The skill is passed down through generations, a living testament to Bequia's maritime heritage. Here, boats aren't just transportation, they are identity. Mustique, paradise with a price. Mustique is known globally for luxury and celebrity visits, yet behind its polished facade, locals have quietly preserved island life. At a local cafe near Britannia Bay, I spoke with Sophia, whose family has lived here for generations. "People see movie stars. We see neighbors," she explained. "We fish the same waters, watch the same stars." I walked quiet trails past mansions to hidden coves where fishermen still gathered nets and children played freely. Even in a paradise built for outsiders, the heartbeat of community endures. Tobago Cays, Guardians of the Reef. The Tobago Cays Marine Park is a protected jewel of biodiversity, renowned for its coral reefs, sea turtles, and clear waters. Here, conservation isn't an option, it's a necessity. I snorkeled among gentle sea turtles, grazing seagrass, and vibrant fish darting between coral heads. Later, Park Ranger Calvin explained the community's conservation efforts. "People depend on reefs for fishing, tourism, culture," he said. "We don't just protect coral, we protect livelihoods." Union Island, Winds of Sustainability. On Union Island, I encountered environmental leadership at the grassroots level. At the Sustainable Grenadines Project Office, young people organized beach cleanups, coral restoration, and sustainable tourism education. "We're small islands," said Akeem, a young organizer. "Climate change affects us first. We have to adapt, or we disappear." At Ashton Lagoon, once threatened by development, locals restored mangroves, creating a thriving habitat again. Their motto was clear: development must respect nature, not destroy it. Petit Saint Vincent, Luxury Meets Local. Petit Saint Vincent, an exclusive eco-resort island, balances luxury and sustainability. Here, solar energy, local employment, and ecological responsibility are priorities. Staff member Terence took me through their organic gardens, supplying fresh produce for guests. "We show guests luxury can respect the environment," he explained. "Our job is to share the Grenadines without selling them." Kariakou, Island of Music and Community. Though part of Grenada politically, Kariakou culturally connects deeply with the Grenadines. Here, maritime traditions blend seamlessly with music and community spirit. I attended the annual Kariakou Regatta, a vibrant festival celebrating traditional boat races, steel pan music, and community pride. Boats built by hand competed fiercely, their sails cutting through clear waters. On shore, music flowed from drums, steel pans, and guitars. An elder named Samuel smiled warmly. "This is us," he said. "Wind, water, song." Cuisine of the Grenadines. Freshness from the sea. Throughout my island-hopping journey, meals were simple yet unforgettable. Fresh grilled snapper, lobster on a beach fire, coconut rice, conch stewed with local spices. On Bequia, I dined at a small roadside shack, savoring fried jackfish and breadfruit chips. The cook, Miss Esther, served her dishes with pride. "Everything you eat here," she smiled, "is caught by someone we know." Where to stay? Grenadines, island hopping experience. Eco-friendly resort, Petit Saint Vincent Resort. Sustainable luxury, private island, approximately $750 per night. Local charm, Frangipani Hotel, Bequia. Historic, affordable, seaside location, approximately $130 per night. Budget-friendly guest house, King's Landing Hotel, Union Island. Family-run, genuine hospitality, approximately $85 per night. Things to do. Grenadines, sailing and sustainability. Visit Bequia's traditional boatyards and meet master boat builders. Explore Tobago Cay's marine park for snorkeling and conservation tours. Join a community eco project or beach cleanup on Union Island. Attend Kariakou Regatta to celebrate maritime heritage and culture. Experience local cuisine at roadside eateries and beachside grills. Walk trails in Mustique, balancing luxury views with authentic community interactions. Budget snapshot. Grenadines. 3 days. Conscious travel. Lodging $390. Cultural activities $75. Food and drinks $100. Sailing and transport $120. Total approximately $685. Final reflection. The Grenadines taught me the art of balance between development and preservation, tradition and progress. Sailing from island to island, I saw more than pristine beaches and turquoise waters. I saw communities fiercely committed to their culture, environment, and future. Here, luxury doesn't erase tradition. Tourism doesn't dilute identity. Each island thrives precisely because it knows what to protect, preserve, and share. In the Grenadines, paradise isn't just beautiful. It's intentional, sustainable, deeply human. Chapter 19, Bahamas, Pirates, Trade Winds, and Hidden Histories. When most people think of the Bahamas, they imagine crystal-clear waters and luxury resorts. But beneath that tranquil surface lie centuries of intrigue, piracy, trade, and resistance. A history preserved in shipwrecks, colonial forts, and oral traditions. My journey began in Nassau, the vibrant capital known historically as a pirate republic, a place where freedom fighters, fortune seekers, enslaved rebels, and outcasts shaped its complex identity. To know Nassau is to dive beneath the surface, literally and figuratively, discovering stories often overshadowed by sand and sunshine. Nassau, city of pirates and contrasts. Walking the narrow streets of Nassau's historic district, felt like moving through layers of time. Pastel-colored colonial buildings stood next to bustling markets filled with spices, crafts, and seafood. But history here isn't just architecture. It's woven through legends of pirates and freedom seekers. At the Pirates of Nassau Museum, I learned how Nassau was once ruled by pirates like Blackbeard, Anne Bonny, and Calico Jack, who defied empires and established their own rough justice. But pirates weren't just outlaws, they also represented early defiance against oppressive colonial authority. My guide, Lucille, explained, "Pirates symbolized freedom in a world controlled by empires. Nassau remembers their courage, not just their crimes." Fort Charlotte, cannons pointing to the sea. High above Nassau, Fort Charlotte watches over the harbor. Built in the late 18th century, its walls tell of British fears, not just of pirate invasions, but of rebellions by enslaved Bahamians. Inside, I walked through dimly lit tunnels and chambers, imagining soldiers awaiting attacks that rarely came. My guide, Samuel, pointed to the harbor below. These cannons were placed here by the British, but many of those who built this fort were enslaved. Imagine building defenses that imprisoned your own freedom. The fort wasn't just defensive, it was symbolic, walls designed to contain both outside threats and internal revolts. Maritime archaeology, shipwrecked histories. Just offshore lie hidden histories waiting to be rediscovered. I joined an archaeological dive near New Providence Island, descending into clear waters, where fragments of 17th century ships lay scattered across the seabed. Our dive leader, Dr. Alicia, explained how these shipwrecks reveal trade routes, cultural exchanges, and struggles for power. We gently examined cannons, pottery, and iron shackles, a stark reminder of the human cost behind colonial trade. "Each wreck tells a story," Dr. Alicia said as we surfaced. "They remind us that paradise was built through turbulence." Clifton Heritage National Park, echoes of Afro-Bahamian resistance. At Clifton Heritage National Park, I encountered a powerful landscape of memory and resistance. Here, ruins of plantation buildings overlook beaches where enslaved Africans first stepped ashore. But this is also a site of freedom. Hidden coves and caves were used by enslaved Bahamians seeking escape. I met historian and activist Angela at the park, who passionately explained, "Clifton isn't just about slavery, it's about courage. This is a place of remembrance and resilience." Walking quietly among limestone ruins, I felt the weight and bravery of countless unknown freedom seekers whose names were never recorded, but whose spirit shaped the island's identity. John Watling's Distillery, Rum and Rebellion. Rum isn't just a Caribbean drink, it's a historical artifact. At John Watling's Distillery, housed in a beautifully restored 18th century estate, I learned how rum-shaped colonial economics fueled pirate ships and even inspired rebellion. My guide, Martin, poured me a sample as he recounted how rum was currency, comfort, and conflict all at once. "Every sip carries stories of sugar plantations, pirate crews, and secret meetings plotting freedom," he said. I tasted history, smooth, sweet, and complex. Rum is more than a beverage here. It's a conversation with the past. Cuisine of Nassau, blending traditions. Bahamas cuisine mirrors its history, African, European, Caribbean, and indigenous influences combined on one plate. In a small downtown eatery, I tried conch salad, fresh and tangy, guava duff, sweet and aromatic, and spicy pigeon peas and rice. The cook, Miss Sylvia, smiled as she watched me enjoy each bite. Food is our way of keeping the past alive. Every dish has ancestors. where to stay. Nassau, heritage-focused. Historic charm. Greycliff Hotel. 18th-century mansion. Luxury heritage experience. Approximately $380 per night. Boutique. Stay. The Island House. Locally owned. Elegant cultural events. Approximately $250 per night. Affordable local inn. Town Hotel. Central Nassau. Friendly atmosphere. Approximately $100 per night. Things to do. Bahamas. Part 1. History and Heritage. Tour the Pirates of Nassau Museum. Visit Fort Charlotte and learn its layered history. Participate in a maritime archaeology dive off Nassau. Explore Clifton Heritage National Park. Take a historical rum tour at John Watling's distillery. Sample authentic Bahamian cuisine in local eateries. A budget snapshot. Nassau, 3 days. Heritage and history. Lodging, $300. Historical tours, $90. Food and drinks, $100. Transport, $70. Total approximately $560. Final reflection. Nassau taught me that paradise isn't simple. It's layered, complicated, and rich with forgotten stories. From pirate republics to colonial forts, enslaved rebellions to maritime mysteries, the Bahamas holds histories deeper than its turquoise waters. This is an island where memory speaks loudly, where every street, fort, and shipwreck tells a story of resistance, survival, and complexity. Nassau reminds us that Caribbean beauty isn't superficial. It's profound, defiant, and deeply human. Chapter 20. Bahamas. Out Islands, Blue Holes, and the Future of Paradise. To truly know the Bahamas, you must sail beyond Nassau, beyond the resorts and bustling cruise ports, into the quiet pulse of the Out Islands, where community, sustainability, and tradition live in harmony with nature. Here, the Caribbean returns to simplicity, guided by rhythms of tide, seasons, and deep ancestral wisdom. My journey took me to these quieter islands, where I found a Bahamas determined to protect its environment, preserve its culture, and shape a sustainable future. Eleuthera, Island of Freedom. My first stop was Eleuthera, a slender island whose name means freedom in Greek. Founded by religious settlers seeking liberty, today it's a place embracing a different freedom, sustainability, and cultural preservation. In Gregory Town, famous for its pineapple farms, I walked fields of fragrant pineapples tended by farmers committed to organic practices. A local farmer named Theo explained, "We care for the land as ancestors did. No chemicals, just patience." Nearby, at Glass Window Bridge, where the dark Atlantic meets turquoise Caribbean, I saw a powerful metaphor of balance between tradition and tourism, nature and development. Harbour Island, beyond pink sands. Just off Eleuthera lies Harbour Island, known for pink sand beaches and colonial charm. Here, tourism supports community rather than overwhelms it. I visited a school teaching marine conservation. Children learned coral planting and ocean stewardship, ensuring the island's future remains sustainable. A teacher named Lorna proudly said, "These children will inherit paradise. We're teaching them how to care for it." At a cafe, I met local chef Jeremy, serving sustainably caught conch fritters and locally grown salads. Our food, our reefs, our culture, they're all connected, he explained. Andros, guardians of the Blue Holes. Andros, the Bahamas' largest yet least developed island, holds ecological wonders, vast forests, mangroves, and mysterious blue holes, deep underwater caves that attract scientists and adventurers alike. I explored these blue holes with Marcus, a local guide passionate about protecting this unique ecosystem. "Blue holes aren't just geological marvels," he said, as we floated above the turquoise abyss. "They're vital freshwater reservoirs and sacred spaces. We guard them fiercely." At Andros's community eco-center, I learned about grassroots efforts against destructive developments. Islanders fiercely defend their natural resources, choosing long-term sustainability over short-term profit. Exuma, island-hopping sustainability. The Exumas, 365 islands and Ks, epitomize island-hopping paradise. But beneath beauty, I found conscious communities committed to environmental stewardship. In Staniel Cay, locals manage protected marine parks, safeguarding reefs and wildlife from over-tourism. My guide, Thomas, pointed to pristine coral. Protecting this isn't optional. It's our survival. Nearby, at a small sustainable resort, guests joined beach cleanups, coral restoration dives, and conservation workshops. Tourism here supports the environment rather than exploits it. Long Island, traditions rooted in resilience. Long Island, serene and sparsely populated, reminded me of Caribbean life before mass tourism. Here, residents practice self-reliance and traditional fishing methods, living harmoniously with their environment. I met Clara, a community leader promoting organic farming and traditional medicine. She showed me gardens of medicinal herbs, passed down through generations. "We don't just live sustainably, we live respectfully," she said. In Clarence Town, fishermen demonstrated sustainable fishing methods, explaining their responsibility to protect marine life for future generations. They taught me, "The sea feeds us, but only if we respect it." Cuisine and community, meals that nourish. Across the Out Islands, meals were simple, sustainable, and communal. Grilled snapper with lime, conch salads, locally harvested vegetables, each meal was a celebration of island bounty and community spirit. At community potlucks in Eleuthera and Andros, dishes reflected local ingredients and cultural pride. "We cook what nature provides," one elder explained. "Our food tastes of the land and sea. Never waste." Where to stay? Bahamas Out Islands, sustainable and authentic. Eco Luxury. Stay Tiamo Resort, Andros. Sustainable, remote eco villas, community driven, approximately $700 per night. Charming boutique, rock house, harbor island. Elegant, community conscious, historical charm, approximately $300 per night. Local experience. Bahama House Inn, Eleuthera. Genuine hospitality, locally operated, affordable comfort, approximately $150 per night. Things to do, Bahamas, Part 2, Community and Ecotourism. Visit organic pineapple farms in Eleuthera. Participate in a coral restoration program in Harbor Island. Explore blue holes with local guides in Andros. Support sustainable fishing communities on Long Island. Join conservation projects or eco-tours in the Exumas. Dine at local eateries featuring fresh, sustainable seafood and produce. Budget snapshot. Bahamas Out Islands. 3 days, eco-conscious. Lodging $450. Eco-tours and community $120. Food and drinks $110. Transport $150. Total approximately $830. Final reflection. exploring the Out Islands taught me that paradise is fragile but resilient, its future shaped by communities dedicated to conservation, culture, and sustainable tourism. These islands revealed a different Bahamas, one committed to guarding nature's gifts, preserving ancestral wisdom, and fostering harmony between humans and their environment. Here, sustainability isn't merely a choice, it's tradition, responsibility, and legacy. The Out Islands aren't just places you visit. They're places that remind you how we all should live, with respect, consciousness, and care.